Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the November 20th, 2017 meeting of Chelan Public Utility District. Today's meeting is a study and a business session, and in case you haven't seen the agenda we have today, we have a very full agenda. So all five commissioners are here and all of the regular staff, and I see a few visitors in the room, but a lot of staff, and I think that I know why with the agenda that we have before us. And as is always the case, this meeting is being recorded. So today, if you wish to speak to any item on the agenda, I ask that you come to the table and use the mic that's sitting there. State your name and address for the record to speak to any agenda item. That would be helpful. Also, I'd like to request that everybody check their cell phones to make sure they're in the silent position. That helps us in the conduct of the meeting, even though sometimes our phones don't cooperate with us. But that's some of us have placed them on silent and had them ring in the past. So anyway, we're in good shape that way.
Yeah, I think, Commissioner Smith, we got to be careful about this agenda because people are going to think we get paid by the pound.
Well, I know the staff doesn't think that, so that's okay. As we always do at the beginning of our meeting, I'd like to begin the meeting with the Pledge of Allegiance and the Safety Minute to be led by Micah Lenderman.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Morning. This safety minute, we're actually going to have a PowerPoint to start it off. Oh, no. All right. Michael Linderman, Management Analyst in District Services. Prior to joining the PUD, I was an actuary for 13 years in the property casualty industry. In property casualty, you learn about seasonality and perils. Texas has hailstorms in spring, then there's tornado season in the Midwest. Hurricane season runs from June through November. Thanksgiving is only one day, but it has its own seasonal loss profile. There are twice as many cooking-related fires on Thanksgiving as emergency rooms treat a disproportionate amount of burn victims. The insurance industry is probably going to pay out $25 million more for accidents which are wholly preventable with basic safety. And the driving reason of these are deep fryers, which is why the insurance industry joined with this guy, William Shatner, and his co-star, the Dingle Dangle, to produce a safety video called Eat, Fry, Love. William Shatner is far more entertaining than any actuary, so check it out. And if William Shatner is not your guy, a couple of guys from Duck Dynasty have a safety video as well. So I recommend both. It'll help drive it home and forward it on to others, too, to get the message out. But since I got you here, get a few deep fryer safety points. Stay away from your house. Don't do this in your garage. Don't do it in your carport. Don't do it underneath your deck. Stay away from low-hanging branches. Keep kids away. Keep pets away as well. Find a flat and level surface. Make sure your turkey is fully defrosted and dry. Water into burning oil don't go well. Ice is even worse. It's more explosive. Remember the principle of displacement. You're going to submerge a turkey into a vat. The oil level is going to rise. So two things to keep in mind with displacement. Make sure you turn off the flame underneath when you stick it in. And use the Dingle Dangle to submerge it. Keep your hand away. Burning oil is 350 degrees. Peanut oil is 350 degrees. It's even hotter than your 212. And, as always, keep a fire extinguisher on hand, but make sure it's multi-purpose. Just as you don't want to put water on a grease fire, make sure that you have the right fire extinguisher for the job. So practice basic safety. You'll stay out of the emergency room. You'll keep the fire department away, and you'll have a much happier Thanksgiving. Thank you.
That was a great safety minute. Thank you very much. Yeah. You weren't the straight man for what I was about to do, because I was also going to do something about Thanksgiving. It's not safety minute related per se, but it's dealing with the authorities. And for most of the people in the room, they probably remember Woody Guthrie, because he wrote Roll On Columbia. He had a son by the name of Arlo. And 52 years ago this Thanksgiving, Arlo got in trouble with his garbage at a place called Alice's Restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And wrote a now famous folk song, Alice's Restaurant, but it was all based around getting trouble with trying to dump his garbage on Thanksgiving Day when the dump was closed. So anyway, that was my moment. So thank you. Commissioners, we have an agenda before us. Management has recommended three of the resolutions 15 through 17, to be moved to the consent agenda. If that does not receive any pushback, we could do that. And at the same time, I'd like to, if there's any other changes that need to happen to the agenda, this is the time for us to discuss those.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adjust the agenda as recommended.
Okay. I'm hearing a push to move items 15 through 17 to the consent agenda. I don't think we have to have a motion to do that, just concurrence. And so thank you, Dennis.
You're welcome.
No, hearing no objection, we will alter the agenda accordingly. Next item on the agenda is advanced metering infrastructure.
We do have a big agenda today. In fact, you can get anything you want.
So, for those of you not old enough to understand that, that was a line out of Alice's restaurant. So,
just want to say that we've talked about advanced metering infrastructure quite a few times this year. We committed as staff that we would get back to you before the end of the year on this subject. And it turns out this is very timely, because we have been working a lot on the customer information system. And as we've come to understand that better, there is a fork in the road with respect to the decision on customer information system. There are three main pieces that you need to have: customer information system, meter data management, and AMI. You need the meter data management because once you have AMI, you're producing so much data, you have to have some way to be able to manage it. So you have a meter data management system to deal with that. As we are looking at CIS systems, we are concluding that the most likely path is that when you choose CIS, you would also choose your meter data management system. We see that decision coming in January. So what we wanted to do is tee up for you a review of where we are on AMI. And hopefully, sometime in the month of December, come to a strategic conclusion about whether we're moving forward with AMI, which we need in order to make an effective customer information system decision. With that, I'm going to turn it over to John and Mark.
Thank you, Steve. John Sowell, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. With me is Mark O'Brien in his new role as the Principal Project Manager for Customer Utilities, focusing on our operational technology, things like the customer information system, meter data management, and AMI. So I know we've got quite the alphabet soup up there, so hopefully those terms have been defined, and that's what we'll rely on as we move forward. So we really haven't been back to speak specifically on these projects since last June, when we had a lot of conversation around the automated metering system, or the AMI system. So this is informative. As Steve has mentioned, there's no decision, just to go over a few things and then look forward to coming back in December for a decision on the AMI. Steve's already related how these technologies are interrelated, so I won't spend too much time on that. We do want to focus a little bit on an overview of Washington State, what I would call AMI, AMR, implementations, a review of regional opt-out policies and fees. We wanted to get back on a discussion around an opt-up approach, as well as what we anticipate steps forward in these efforts, provided we get an approval to go forward. One thing up front, this we've covered a lot of ground, so I'll touch briefly on the business case, but this isn't designed to go through a lot of the issues we've covered. On our website, we have a lot of the information around health, around privacy, around data security. So just for the audience, we still have that out there on our website.
So with that, what I want to do is spend a little bit of time and just kind of discuss where we're at on the CIS MDM discussion and strategy, and how that supports a potential AMI decision to come. So currently, the district is looking at a new integrated application package from Oracle, which takes the billing system, the CIS system, and integrates that directly with an MDM system. Typically in the industry, these are separate applications that require significant effort to integrate those, interface those together, coordinate those. This is a relatively new product. Existing products that they've, a new delivery of those products is to combine those into one package. So that's one of the benefits we have with the current direction on CIS. Again, we'll be coming to the board for final discussion on purchasing an application as well as an implementation partner, hopefully early in Q1 of next year. So some of the benefits of that are it includes all those integrations related to the MDM capabilities. It allows us to configure that all up front in advance of an AMI system. So we're getting way down the road related to making that AMI implementation and decision a lot more streamlined. We've also been able to implement a demo environment on the application. So we were already testing and working with the applications, getting understanding of how to configure those, how to work with those, how to leverage them once they are up and running. So that's kind of where we're at with the current strategy of CIS, MDM. Some of those outcomes, like I mentioned before, it will allow us a more phased-in approach for the AMI. So we don't have to go out and establish an MDM application along with an AMI decision. We can focus on the AMI technology. We can further refine MDM. Again, a lot of configurations, the requirements. What do you want to get out of that system? Work through all of those decisions and discussions in advance. Potentially do a pilot of an AMI system. We'll have all the infrastructure to leverage an AMI system so we can actually pilot one in advance of moving forward on a final decision on a particular vendor in the event the board directs us to move forward on AMI. And overall, it will just streamline the old RFP process, the request for proposals, so we can get a more focused vision of what we're actually looking for. We can get more specific responses back from the vendor community and have us focus in on the true requirements of what we're looking for on AMI. So that's kind of in a nutshell where we're at with the CIS efforts and how that will be leveraged going forward in the event the board opts to move forward on an AMI type deployment.
I mentioned I was going to briefly talk about the business case. These are the hard numbers that were developed as part of the business case. We did a version back in 2015, and then late last year into January, we updated it. It's positive net present value, a little over $1 million. The capital costs we anticipate for this project, a little over 13. The benefits estimate over 20-year life is about $33 million. The internal rate of returns, a little over 8%, and a payback in 14 years. One thing in looking at this, we have a very conservative business case. We've looked at other business cases. Folks have valued a lot of other benefits. I would call them softer benefits, but they're there. But for our purpose of this exercise, we didn't value those. However, we do see the opportunity for benefits. Those really tangible benefits are there. And I just wanted to walk through an example. Since the board approved the high-density load rate last year, our staff spends probably up to 10 hours a week just monitoring what could be potential high-density load, cryptocurrency mining. It's a lot of manual processes to setting data loading, logging meters, going out, reviewing that, pulling the data, following up. A metering system such as an AMI, that's pretty much all built in, so you can have pre-built queries, things of that nature, all the data that would tell you right away, this looks like a high-density load operation, and then that would trigger an application process. So that's a benefit when we put the business case together we didn't know about. So just an example.
Hey, we ask questions. Do you mind if we ask?
Sure.
All right. So the base case, which you have shown up there, that is the base case for CIS MDM.
Strictly
for that, which would then make it possible. That would then make it possible to integrate AMI, but that's not for AMI.
This is for AMI.
It's for the whole package.
Yeah. And I would also say when we...
It's just for AMI, not the whole package of... So we just pulled out the AMI piece.
Oh, you did? Oh, I missed that. Yeah. Really?
One thing I would add to that, this business case was established with the understanding that the MDM component would be a part of this deployment. And so we will be going down the path quite a ways on the CIS implementation if that decision is made to move forward. And so that, again, that includes a component of that, which we'll be addressing as part of the CIS project as well. But primarily this is just for the AMI and associated efforts.
Okay, so as long as I have you stopped here, the pilot, you talked about the pilot for the AMI. What would that look like? How involved, how big would that be?
Yet to be determined. Again, depending upon where the board direction, we may look at taking a small sampling of AMI-type meters, identifying potential backhaul mechanisms to get the data back to the district. Again, it will depend on the RFP, who responds to it, and what options we have related to testing some of that technology.
Would we have a better sense of that? Will we have a better sense of that before we make our decision in 2 weeks or 4 weeks?
Really, what we're looking for is a decision on really the strategy of AMI, not on a decision on moving forward, tomorrow or the next day. We would follow up the CIS implementation with the AMI. So that's still out in 2019. Would probably be the earliest we would see an AMI decision as far as a vendor and selection process.
Okay.
This is really just saying we're moving forward with the CIS MDM combination application with the potential to leverage CIS, just making sure we're on the same page on that decision. And when we configure the CIS and MDM applications and prepare that for potentially an AMI solution in the future.
So those kinds of decisions are going to come later. More specifically, how much and how long?
Related to AMI, that is correct. It's really the strategy decision. Are we going to move forward and prepare for that decision in the future as far as the actual technology solution?
I think the key piece here, the meter data management system, you would really only purchase that if you were going to go with an automated metering system because of all the data it needs to handle. So if we, absent an AMI decision, you would probably save money, time, and effort not doing a meter data management system.
Thanks. I'll go ahead and I'll let you go through the rest of this and then see if my questions get answered.
Quick question. Just for understanding purposes, would the MDM create variance reports that are then easily identifiable for staff to determine the illustration you talked about with cryptocurrency?
Yes, yeah. You'd have lots of flexibility to set up reports and queries that would give you that information.
Okay, so it removes a manual search.
Yeah, it would remove what we may spend up to 10 hours a week on one customer.
Okay, thank you.
Just a more narrative around the business case, and this is looking at it from a customer perspective, how this would it drive customer satisfaction. Reduces the length and frequency of outages, how you would get the information out, how do you manage the outage. When customers call in for high bill issues, you've got a lot of information right at your fingertips to satisfy their requests, so it reduces cost in the and turnaround in that customer conversation. Customers would have a lot of information to use, whether that's looking at conservation opportunities, efficiency opportunities to help their decision-making. It would be foundational for future customer-centric programs, whether it's something like a prepay, which is pretty popular with utilities that have this, or even customers who wanted to use that for their own, maybe apps or things of that nature. And then again, overall, it's a positive business case, so it helps keep rate pressure low. Operationally, certainly on the meter reading side, it will save significant money, but there's a lot of truck rolls that we do for meter sets, turn-ons, turn-offs, inquiries, things of that nature. It will reduce that significantly. Call center costs, outage costs, and restoration costs would be reduced, improves meter accuracy. As we move more and deeper into asset management strategies, all that data that we will receive will be very valuable in making decision-making around capital projects and investments in the system, and will improve safety and reduce our emissions.
Quick question on, you estimated a couple slides back, 20-year life on the meters.
Correct.
Knowing what we have in place right now, how conservative is that 20-year estimate?
I think that 20-year is pretty ballpark. I mean, I think that's a reasonable, it's a digital meter. One of the benefits we've had from some of the electromechanical meters, they're mechanical, so they'll run indefinitely. They may slow down, but you can get 50, 60 years out of those. Where a digital meter, it's binary, it's electronic. I would anticipate that 20-year life is, from what we've seen and what UtilaWorks has put forward, the vendor, the consultant we've used, sounds reasonable.
May I follow up on his question?
Sure.
So if we did have to replace the meters, maybe in 10 years, maybe in 20 years, Is that then, are we then going to have to go back and replace our meter meter data management system software? I'm not sure how they're all linked together. I'm trying to get a sense of that.
I would envision in 20 years we'll probably have a lot of different solutions to maybe look at. For example, the CIS system we're replacing now is essentially about 12, 13 years old. And so we're replacing that with, you know, the current customer information system that will serve our needs. 20 years from now, it would probably be a different landscape as well.
So this would all look different if we didn't adopt AMI. We wouldn't need the meter data management system.
We probably wouldn't need that, but we certainly need a new customer information system. And where we're looking at an Oracle system, which is the next progression from our current PeopleSoft system. So it has a lot of, you know, state-of-the-art offerings. But what we've seen is, you know, the packaging of the meter data management system just helps utilities, you know, manage that data. But again, it really, I guess the example that really kind of hits home with me is, you know, we may process, call it 650,000 data points. Those are information from the meter. A lot of it goes for billing. A lot of it is a monthly data point. We do have more data for our industrial customers. Demand reads, things of that nature. With an AMI system, we would be around conservatively 5 billion data points. So how do you manage all that data through a meter data management system, and how does it feed all the different programs and applications where you get that value out of it? That's why it's critical to have a meter data management system when you look at an AMI system. This next slide I thought was really handy. This credit goes to Andy Wendell on this. He put it together maybe several months ago. I've used it with customers who've said, why are you on the leading edge with this AMI? And I've described to them, when you look across the footprint of the state, and this is very busy. It's focused on PUDs, but keep in mind you've got Pacific Core, you've got Avista, you've got Puget Sound Energy, the larger IOUs in the state, as well as about a half dozen, I think, co-ops. And when you go through that, I would conservatively say probably about a third of the utilities are about where we're at, where they're looking at, well, where do we go? The rest of them either have AMR or AMI either in place or they're implementing right now. Seattle City Light's a good example. I think this summer they started doing their implementation. Grant has just started theirs as well. What we've learned, too, is, you know, looking at the opt-out, we will have an opt-out program. This is very high level, but we know customers will have a choice. We know there's traditionally additional costs with, you've got a one-off to your system, so how do you set up the meter, the manual meter reading process, what it takes to do that. We understand not having those AMI meters leave data gaps. You're not getting all the benefits out of it. Utilities obviously want to get as close to 100% as possible. What we've seen, usually utilities in our spot who are just starting, what would they estimate? Maybe less than 1% would choose an opt-out. In our case, call it 500 meters. We listened to a presentation on AMI from some big players like Sacramento Municipal Utility District, Salt River Project, a couple of publics who were probably early on in the AMI. It was interesting. I know, you know, SMUD Sacramento went through a lot of, you know, I would say, some customer pushback. There are 650,000 meters. They've got 500 who've chosen to opt out. Salt River is 1 million customers, and they've got about 500 as well. So they're well under that 1%. So I just thought that was interesting to hear that update. And Salt River, they're actually on their second generation of AMI.
So the people who have opted out are either maintaining their analog, they still have their analog meter, or they've gone to AMR one way. Do most of them have one-way meters?
They could have a number of choices. I'm not familiar with what individual utilities. Most likely they have just a standalone old-fashioned style meter. Analog. It's probably not mechanical. It's probably just a digital meter. Or it could be, and I touch on this, you've seen the meters evolve where you can have a AMI meter, but the RF communication's turned off. So it just reads like
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, so with an AMR one-way meter, you can turn the communication off?
Not with a one-way, with a two-way AMI meter. We've seen that being developed in the industry. So they may have that.
Basically functions just mechanically.
It's just a visual readout, yeah. So you still have to have somebody go up and actually read the meter.
So just to kind of clarify, sorry, because I unfortunately have to leave today. So our customers who have an old analog meter that breaks down and they need a replacement, we're not replacing the analog meters because we can't get them?
Correct.
Is that right?
Yeah, we have one meter standard, and that's the one-way meter, so that's what we replace our meters with. And that we probably, I think we're around 40% of all our meters are the one-way meters.
And the radio frequencies surrounding the one-way meters are higher throughout the day than they are for the new, for the AMI meters.
I think what we've seen with the AMI meters is they bundle up, and you can decide when do you want to send or broadcast back to the utility the information. Or the one-way meters just assume somebody's going to drive by or walk by and pick up its read. Yeah. And there's various styles within those type of meters.
Do we have any customers who've chosen to stick with their analog meter or tried to get a different analog meter so that they didn't have to move into the AMI?
I believe every meter we've replaced has been with the one-way AMR.
Okay, thank you.
Bottom bullet, you know, as we move forward and we understand what our technology profile and policies, we will have a program that will help customers on their decision. This is just illustrative. It's just an example when looking around the state. Again, those utilities who have a AMI or an AMR system in place, what do they have for an opt-out fee? So some of them have a one-time fee. You can see Benton PUD, if you choose to go with a single walk-up meter, they have a $90 installation fee. Cowlitz has $135. Some of them don't have it. Some of them are thinking about it. And then the various monthly fees, you can see it's from $15 to $50. That's the range for that reoccurring monthly fee to recover the cost of having a separate opt-out approach. So, and you can see several of them are, you know, they're right in the middle of determining their policy. I think Grant is out there. They've had some information and some proposals, but I don't think they've determined anything yet.
John, is there any utility that has a no opt-out model? In other words, they've just said this is our minimum standard. We're moving to that. And
I believe there's several in the state that have that. We've touched on this already, so I won't spend a whole lot of time, but it just gives you some various examples of kind of that acquiring an AMI meter with the capability to turn it off. There's a lot of benefit there from the standpoint. If somebody moves in and wants it, you've already got the meter there, and with today's technology and software, you can turn that on remotely. Another option would be, again, just not replacing it, relying on the one-way meter. Another one would be, is there a way to gain the benefits and maybe have a relocation at a metering spot that's further away from an existing meter base? We would look to do that potentially at a shared cost. But these are just some examples. I think the key thing is once we get responses back from an RFP, we would see what options would be available, and then that would kind of help develop the full roster of options. The opt-up recommendation, the quick definition of that is there a way to provide the same customer and utility benefits of an advanced two-way metering, typically using some sort of a wired technology or a non-RF technology? We've spent some time reviewing it. We believe there's some potentials out there, but they're pretty limited. So the staff recommendation at this part is to not make that a hard requirement within an RFP. We want to keep our RFP as broad, Big Ten as possible to evaluate all the solutions that would potentially come in. You know, out of that, we may uncover what would be potential options to work with. So, again, we're not recommending making that a hard and fast rule within our RFP, but to evaluate that once we see the technologies. We want to do that for a couple of reasons. Mainly, I think we would limit who our responders would be, and I think we would see the cost being driven up. But again, keep it open and let's evaluate it as we get responses. So to close this out, just wanted to go through some projected next steps. And of course, there's a big board decision in December on the AMI. So this is predicated, these next steps, if that approval is granted, how we would move forward on the CIS, the meter data management, and the AMI system. And I'll turn it over to Mark to walk through that.
Thanks, John. Going forward, if the board directs us to incorporate an AMI strategy, we'd be looking to come to the board to formalize an implementation contract for the CIS system, which includes the MDM components, in Q1 of next year. Looking to initiate that project into Q1, early part of Q2, that'll be somewhat dependent upon the availability of the implementation partner that we contract with. Again, during the course of that project, that will inform us on further refining our AMI requirements, getting the RFP out. And so we will be developing that in the early stages of the CIS implementation, and actually develop that toward the end of next year, Q3, Q4, develop that RFP and look to get that out at the end of the year or the first part of 2019, come to the board for approval of that RFP, identify the appropriate system by Q2 of 2019, again, come to the board and get approval of that. We're looking at that CIS implementation to go live probably in Q2 of 2019, depending upon when we actually start that. We're looking at about a 15-month window for the CIS MDM implementation. And so as we finish that up, we would be looking to initiate the AMI project in the mid-2019. Again, at that same time, we would be finalizing those opt-out policies and bringing those to the board in advance of rolling out the AMI project in full. And then following that, depending upon how we employ that or deploy that, whether it's internal resources or we contract out the actual installation of those meters and infrastructure, look at that going through 2020 in general. So it's a pretty lengthy project by the time you add up all these different phases of it. But again, this is all based upon getting that clear direction and having us then plan for that over the course of the next several years. Any questions on that schedule? Again, this is a rough schedule. A lot of these are dependent upon availability and decisions and et cetera along the way. So with that, any other questions on schedule or any other concepts?
Any questions from any member of the commission? Any member of the public have any questions or comments on this presentation? I think staff is indicating that they'd like to get a feel from the commission as to they want to bring this back in December. We have two meetings in December. Any sense of the commission earlier or later in December?
So the December decision is a conceptual decision. If approved, then that would give staff the direction they need to proceed with the whole package of recommendations.
Correct. Starting with the CIS, MDM, when we start configuring that and purchasing that, I would note that when we do look to contract for that application, we won't be turning on the MDM to its full capability, and so we won't be paying for the full license. And so we will be installing it, though. We wouldn't be paying for it until we needed it, but that would inform us on the extent we configured it and prepared for AMI.
Okay, thank you.
So we would see it as a head nod strategic decision. There's not a resolution. There's not a commitment of money, but we would know that's the path we're on. And by January, likely, you'd be seeing a CIS decision that includes MDM. So we want to make clear there is a fork in the road here and choosing which path we want to go down.
So if we did approve that to move ahead, there would be, it talks here about refining the opt-out policies. The assumption is there would be an opt-out policy.
Correct.
If we vote yes to go ahead with this, there will be some sort of an opt-out policy. We just don't know what it looks like.
Correct.
Subject to, a board can always change its mind at a future date, but I think you've been very clear with us that that we have, that there should be that kind of policy, and we're planning to develop one and have one ready for you.
That's what I've been advised by every other utility I've spoken to. And so one last question. If we did decide to go ahead with the AMI two-way RF meters, one of the options is people could turn off the RF signal. So then how are those read? They're just read.
It would be a walk-up.
Like the walk-up read. Analog walk-up.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Do you know if other utilities have offered that? Well, if it's available, do you know if other people are taking advantage of that?
Andy, have you? I'm going to look to Andy because I know he's done a lot of the research. I can't speak of one that has. I think as the software for these meters gets better and more deployable, these type of options are being put out there.
so that
I read his mind.
So John, that's a I don't know, in my mind, if you have health concerns, if there are real serious health concerns, that's a better option than the AMI one-way meter, which is sending out a signal continuously.
Time. Right, yeah.
Correct?
Correct, yeah. In a perfect world, we'd have a solution that, you know, streamlined our costs so we didn't have multiple standards, but provided that choice as well.
Great.
So, John, I think this is starting to answer my question of how do you set the minimum standard for a business model and yet provide some options for people that have concerns. And this seems to address that. But my question is, for the PUD, what is the benefit of putting in the new meter? And, or is there a benefit of putting in that new meter even if the individual decides to opt out?
You could possibly do some sort of data logging with that meter if you wanted to then manually go through the process to download it. Again, I'm probably speaking it a little ahead of where the technology may be, but that potentially could be an option. I think the bigger issue, and I know Andy has thought a lot about this and has looked at other ways that, you know, how can you just minimize the number of opt-outs? And I think through a really strong process, you can work with customers. So over time, you would see that if it's less than 1%, getting down to that level that a SMUD or an SRP has where it's just, you know, out of a million meters, they've got 500 folks who are opting out. In our case, that would be just, if, you know, relatively would be a handful. So if you can get to that point over time, I think that would be the best approach.
I just want to clarify the December, because here it says board decision, and then, Steve, I thought I heard you say head nod. So are we looking for, action, or are we looking toward nodding that will lead to action?
I consider a head nod a decision, so that's okay. What we've been treating them. So when you, when on strategic facilities plan,
right.
On our strategic plan,
actually. Right.
So there are places along the way where we don't have a formal resolution that requires an action by the board. Expenditure of dollars usually is what constitutes that. But in this case, it would be, okay, we know that you are comfortable that we are proceeding
right.
with AMI as our strategy, and there will be a set of implementation steps that you'll actually be voting on in the coming months.
Okay. Thank you. That helps clarify.
Gary.
So the software program that you're talking about doing sounds quite complex, but there's been implementation at other PUDs and utility companies, both in the state of Washington and also around the country. Is there packages? Are there packages of software that have been tested so that we're not creating a software that has a potential risk? Is that what we're looking at?
What I would say is they're prepackaging it in a different fashion. So Oracle has had these applications independent of each other, and which would require you to then have an implementer come in and tie them together because they talk back and forth. They both have similar information. They're tracking premises. They're tracking customers, locations. They're both doing that for their own purpose. And so typically what you have to do is you have to interface those. When you change one, it needs to change the other. What they've done is they've gone and they've programmed or written the interfaces into that application and brought those under one application. So now that information, there's it's synchronized between both those applications. And so you install it as one system, one interface with other systems. We interface this with many systems, our GIS, graphical interface system, our general ledger, where our financial information goes. So it creates one point to connect to all the other systems and one interface for the users and the customers. So all that data resides under one database. So that's really the change that's occurred recently in the industry as they continue to expand the capabilities of a billing system or a CIS. So that's the technology we're looking at. And again, we're looking at only turning on the components that we're fully going to be using initially, but we're going to be ahead of the game by configuring it and establishing that MDM, meter management component, in advance of an AMI solution.
One of the challenges with software is you can take the latest and greatest, which gives you the longest life, but you take the risk that it's new and how well it worked out, how many bugs you have to deal with. On the other hand, you can take one that's well established, but candidly has become stale. And so now you're dealing with the shortened life, most likely, that you're going to have for that software. What a big debate that's been going on here for close to a year now is, where do we want to end up on that? How are we trying to manage that? I'm going to see if I capture this correctly, and Mark, you can correct me if I get it wrong, but basically what we're doing is taking a pretty well-established CIS system, pretty well-established MDMS system, but the vendor is putting those two together. That's what's relatively new here. And so take a little bit of risk with respect to that, but that puts us in a better position, we think, because it's going to be latest and greatest of both put together, but reasonably well-established that they have worked in the past.
That's a fair statement, yes.
And as those two come together, then the benefit for the customer themselves is?
Well, I think the customer benefits.
Better access to information.
Correct. And better means for staff to provide that access rather than tap into two different systems or multiple systems. They want to have billing information versus usage information. Those are now under the same umbrella. So it makes it a like cleaner interface for us to develop solutions for the customer. In a more effective manner.
Yeah, I understand that Oracle has purchased PeopleSoft and has completely retooled and basically made it one-stop shopping for this type of application.
Right, and that was quite a while ago that
right.
they purchased PeopleSoft. They've evolved
right.
it over time.
Right, and so yeah,
where it is today.
Some nice generational work.
Right, it's relatively consistent related to the database structures on the individual CIS application to what we currently have.
Yeah.
So it's not a huge transition to another system like occurred previously
right.
when we went to PeopleSoft.
Right.
Get back to the question, December.
I'll just make a quick proposal. At this point, we don't, as staff, know of additional questions that we would be answering. And the reason that we were thinking of a choice between December 4th and the second meeting in December was really focused on whether we needed to do more work to respond to questions that had come up. So at this point, we would be recommending the first meeting in December for that decision point.
December 4th?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
That's a nod.
Okay. Good.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Powerhouse 2.
Okay. I'm going to take a second to introduce this one as well just a moment. We have known for a long time that work was needed to be done at Powerhouse 2, and it's generally been in our financial forecast in the 2020s. What you're going to see is a review of thinking through just what work needs to be done, what the costs roughly are going to be. The decision for the board, though, is not whether to proceed with the full refurbishment of the units at Powerhouse 2. The decision for the board that will be teed up in a resolution this afternoon is whether to spend $5 million to do the engineering and design work that would put us in a position to be able to begin doing the actual refurbishment work in the 2021 timeframe. Sometimes that can get lost. It's a $350 million decision as to do whether to do full refurbishment. We are not calling that question at this point. We're calling the question as to, do we know enough at this point to begin to do this engineering and design work recognizing that things will change between now and then. We'll get better estimates on cost. We'll understand the market better. And so we will be reviewing the actual bigger decision later. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Brett Bickford and John Stegerson.
Good morning. I'm Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management. I'm very proud and excited to bring this presentation on Powerhouse 2 for you today. It's about a two-year effort that we've spent on this. I want to thank a lot of staff members for, with all the different activities and disruptions and change that happened throughout the year, they stayed focused and were able to work through this rehabilitation feasibility study. And that's what we'd like to present for you today. And John Sagister's been leading that effort again and stayed focused even with all the change at Rock Island. John?
Good morning. I'm John Sagister, and I am the project manager for this project. I'm also the engineering department manager down at Rock Island. Today I really get to be the spokesperson, though, for the bigger team that Brett mentioned, who did all the research and analyzed the different options associated with Rock Island Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation. Our objectives today are to present really the recommendations for scope, schedule, and budget for a proposed rehabilitation program at Rock Island. We'd like to get your concurrence with that proposed program. And then, as Steve mentioned, we do have a resolution this afternoon seeking approval to execute a new service agreement for engineering support in support of the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 project. Our discussion topics today will give you a little bit of background on Rock Island Powerhouse 2. We don't talk about that much because it is different than all the other units that we have. We'll go through some of the condition indicators, what makes us think that now is the time that we need to start this program, some of the alternatives that we explored, as well as the recommendations for scope and schedule. We'll go through the economics. What does this mean for a budget? We'll also go through what the ongoing risks and issues are that we'll be facing and trying to mitigate as part of the program. A little bit of planning and coordination steps that are already in progress and what we see as resource needs to implement this program, and then what the next steps are really for the board. As I mentioned earlier, I'm really just the spokesperson. You can see from this slide that the most departments within the district were involved in doing some research, analyzing, and taking a look at these different alternatives. This brings a broad perspective to each and every recommendation that you'll see today. Rock Island Powerhouse 2 was built in the mid-70s. It has 8 units total. Each one is approximately 51 megawatts. They are somewhat unique to our fleet of generating units here at Chelan County PUD because they're horizontal bulb units. We have a picture of one over here on the side. So basically, if you take the typical vertical Kaplan units that we have at Rock Island Powerhouse 1 and at Rocky Reach, you turn it on your side, you put it in a submarine in the middle of the water passage, and you have a bulb unit. Bulb units are designed for low head, high flow installations, which is ideal for Rock Island. And they are also extremely efficient. And we'll go into that detail a little bit more on some of the other slides. They were went into commercial operation in 1977-1978. By 1985, we had found that we had some generator stator frames cracking due to thermal expansion issues with those units. So we negotiated with the original manufacturer at that point in time, a company called Alstom Nearpick. And we replaced the generators or repaired them in the late 80s and early 90s. Some of our condition indicators, these units have been running very well, I might add. So they've run fairly steadily with only routine maintenance since the generators have been replaced in the late 80s. But we are starting to see some things. The stator windings and the generator stator in a hole is one of our main concerns. We've had insulation testing on two of the units that have failed prior to reaching full voltage on the test. This is an indication that the insulation systems of the generators are starting to fail and that the insulation is breaking down. Also on the stator windings, on some of the intern windings, we're starting to see signs of vibration damage, signs of corona, and damaging insulation in those areas of the generator as well. The rotor poles have also failed insulation tests. It's called a DC ramp test. So we've had two units in the last probably 4 years that have had rotor poles that have failed these ramp tests, and so we've had to remove those out of service and send them out to be refurbished. Fortunately, we had spares on site, so that it didn't take an extended outage to do that. The trunnion seals on the turbine. The trunnion seals are designed to seal the turbine hub from the water passage. These are typically 20-year wear items. Due to corrosion and erosion in the seal area, though, we're having to replace those every 4 years now. Some of the runner blade clearances, you can see where how the turbine has tight clearances around the discharge ring. The discharge ring itself is becoming oblong. It's no longer round, and we're having some turbine blade strikes. Let me show you. Kind of in this area right in here. This discharge ring and the turbine blade. this piece here is no longer round, and so as the turbine spins around, it's coming into contact and creating damage on the turbine blades and also on the discharge liner, which is one of the key components to keep the water where it needs to be. And then the lube oil injection pumps, they're the leading cause of start failures at Rock Island Powerhouse 2 units. So the alternatives explored are we've looked at replacing the units outright with new turbines and new generators, and then, of course, we've looked at rehabilitating the existing turbine generators that we've had. In looking at the new turbines, we worked with the turbine generator manufacturers to determine if there was any potential increases in efficiency or capacity that we could gain from these particular units. What we found really is that the increases, though, were fairly minimal in both capacity and efficiency, and this resulted in a lower return on investment relative to the rehabilitation option. Also, because it was a new design, a new hydraulic capacity, new hydraulic signature, there was a high likelihood that we would have to open up our FERC license and have some sort of an amendment, capacity or non-capacity amendment, prior to our relicensing. Also, again, because it was a new design, there was a high likelihood that we would need to spend some time investigating and testing what are the impacts to fish passage and other environmental concerns, and spend quite a bit of time redemonstrating our compliance to our habitat conservation plan, total dissolved gas issues, and some things like that. The last concern is we see that a lot of new designs end up with some uncertainty of reliability, operations, and maintenance. Because they're new and a little bit less tested, you need to spend some time. The generator frame cracking issue on Powerhouse 2 is a prime example of that. This slide shows you some of the efficiency and why we didn't get a whole lot of additional efficiency. This green line here is the new turbines and turbine generators at Rock Island Powerhouse 1 for B5 through B10. This orange line is the new turbine generators for B1 through B4. And this blue line is the existing turbine generators for Rock Island Powerhouse 2. So as you can see, they are extremely efficient, even relative to modern new designs, and doesn't leave us a lot of room there to increase. Also, the turbine manufacturers said we'd get about a percent increase in efficiency for the new units. So the main objective of the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 Rehabilitation Project is to maintain the overall plant reliability for the next 40 years. So in order to ensure that we have another 40 years, we need to rehabilitate some of the major components and in order to ensure that we get that remaining life. We have gone through and done a stress analysis, a fatigue analysis of those major components, and they are all calculating and show that if we do this rehabilitation, they will have another 40-plus years of remaining life in them. We do recommend that we would replace the wear components, seals, bushings, fasteners, instrumentation, things along those lines, just to make sure that we get extended life. We also recommend that we would procure one new generator for the first unit, and this would accelerate the overall schedule by approximately 2 years. So we'd buy a brand new generator, put it in of the first unit that we're rehabilitating, and we'd take that old generator out, and then while we finish that unit, we would rehabilitate the generator, rewind it, restack it, blast and paint the frame, things like that, and then it would be prepared and like new, ready to go into the second unit. We also propose procuring some new components in order to mitigate some of the costs and schedule risks for the overall project. This is a list of the proposed wear components that we would replace. We don't intend to go through each and every one of these today, but it does give you a visual of the amount of work and the amount of detail that it does that's required to replace or rehabilitate a unit. These are the what we call risk mitigation components. So really what we're proposing to do is to purchase one new of each of these components in order to mitigate cost and schedule risks within the project. These may end up as spares. They may be used. A prime example of this is the turbine shaft. We bought one of these new turbine shafts for Rock Island Powerhouse 1. It was reusable. We could reuse it, but the subcontractor ended up going bankrupt, and so our shaft got locked up, and so we ended up having to use our spare here in order to keep the project on schedule. Most of these items are long lead times. They have, you know, it takes a year or so to design, to build new ones and things like that, so if one of these components was not able to be reused for any reason, then that would save us quite a bit of time and cost. Our outage schedule, we propose to start outages beginning in September of 2021. The first unit outage would be planned for 16 months. Again, these units really haven't been gone into since the late 80s, early 90s, so we think that we've got some lessons we need to learn with that first outage. The second unit would start immediately after the first outage. Following that, though, we would plan to start overlapping our unit outages. So as we reach a stage in reassembly of the second unit, we would start disassembly of the third unit. This would allow us to save approximately 3 months of time for each unit and shorten the overall duration of the program. Subsequent unit outages would be overlapped as well. We also expect that our learning curve would go away, so the future outages would be 12 months in duration rather than the 16 months. Go forward. So this is kind of a visual of the overall schedule. It gives you an idea of the overlap of the outages. You can start seeing some of the overlap here on the second and third units. The overlap and the sequence of the outage is important because it supports our habitat conservation plan relicensing efforts. By completing the project prior to the 2030 HCP check-in, also the sequence of the outages supports ongoing fish passage and predation issues. Our budget, we're estimating it's going to be $313 million just for the turbine and generator rehabilitation for all 8 units. We expect an additional $39 million for the balance of plant projects. These are all the supporting systems, water, electric distribution, cooling systems, HVAC systems, sewer system, oil handling systems. All of these balance of plant projects, though, are funded separately and justified as standalone projects. So those all come under a separate approval and budgeting process. It does give us a total of $352 million that we expect to spend at Rock Island Powerhouse 2 between now and 2029. It will be included in all of your annual budgets. So for... And it is included in the 2018 annual budget in an amount of $1.8 million that we expect to spend next year in the engineering efforts. The overall economics include some of the values we include energy capacity, carbon encroachment, unit costs, risk mitigation components, and all of those were included in the cost component. It produces an internal rate of return of 16.2%. And just doing some sensitivities, if we look at some of the lower future energy price curves, we're still seeing a positive internal rate of return, but much lower at 10.9%. Some of the ongoing risks and issues that we're facing, component condition is probably the biggest one. Even with this recommended schedule, we're expecting to run into some forced outages before we finish the overall program in 2029. Just looking at some of our asset management information, asset management data, we're expecting that we would have approximately 7 years of forced outages on the differing units because of stator failures or turbine trunnion seals or some other similar issues before we're able to get to those units and rehabilitate them.
I want to make sure you caught that point. That was a really important point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the more we do asset management work, the more we're coming to understand the state of our assets. And what we're finding is that with these units, we've got some significant risk of forced outage. We would have even considered going faster on this project, except that we've got so much work already going on in the B units at Rock Island that we didn't feel like we could go faster. So I wanted to make sure that point didn't go by, that we've got some issues here that it's, from looking at it, that it's time to get after them.
We also do expect some impacts to plant operations. Rock Island Powerhouse 2 is designed fairly uniquely with removable roof systems, so we'll have the roof off the powerhouse for much of the project, exposing the turbine, the generator, and more importantly, plant staff to the elements where they are not used to that. We also have several ongoing projects at Rock Island. The rehabilitation of project of Powerhouse 1 would overlap with this effort, so we'd have two major rehabilitation efforts going on at the same time, as well as the site facility plan, which you're aware of at Rock Island. So as we start to plan on this, we're planning the preparation of the bidding documents and solicitation of proposals from the turbine and generators. You've also seen some of the results for the safety evaluation that we've done at Rock Island Powerhouse 1 for the B1 through B4 units. We plan on doing something similar for Powerhouse 2, and so we're working on that. We also plan a site utilization plan. Rock Island Powerhouse 2 is fairly small, so all of those major components are going to have to come out of the powerhouse, and they're going to have to go somewhere. So how do we get them there? How do we handle them? Where do we store them? That will be one of the efforts of the utilization study. And also some of the engineering that will be done as part of the service agreement that we're proposing to you this afternoon.
John, a question. In terms of the uniqueness of these turbines, particularly in our situation, so the components that we will, purchase are, is that a single source?
You
had the long list of components that we might be buying that could end up as spares or utilized or both.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a single source?
I think he's meaning for procurement purposes.
Yes.
Is it a sole source declaration?
It's a sole source declaration. No.
Okay.
No.
So there are other people who manufacture the same things that...
So the three big turbine generator manufacturers, you're familiar with them.
Mm-hmm.
All of them make bulb units.
Okay.
And would have capabilities of engineering new shafts or other replacement components.
Okay.
Yeah. So it would not be sole source.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, single, sole, yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect, thank you.
Yep. So coordination, as I mentioned previously, coordination with the facilities program, we would need to utilize some of the new buildings that they are planning at this point in time, and then coordination with the other rehabilitation efforts going on at the spillway and at Powerhouse 1. Significant resources would be required to execute this project scope. We expect a dedicated staff of approximately 10 people. It would be a mix of district full-time employees, limited assignment employees, and contractors. And because of that, coordination within the team would be paramount. We would also expect that we'd need to revise some of our existing procedures in order to accommodate an increased use of contractors. We do expect additional contracted support is estimated really at $5.25 million, and that's the value of the service agreement that we'll be presenting this afternoon. We'll spend that amount between now and 2022. Again, the service agreement would be a task authorization agreement, so it would be subject to annual budgets as approved by the board.
Let me also interject for a moment here. That been trying to figure out where to address this question of new positions, and it has not been in the budget documents that you've seen so far. It is included in the budget document you will see this afternoon. We've been having a lot of conversation about how to manage this. What we have is really a peak load work problem because we're going to be trying to be doing work at the Rock Island B units at the same time as we're preparing for the work at the U units here. The challenge was, well, how do you manage that? We do actually need them to be district employees for purposes of dealing with all of the regulatory requirements that we've got. But at the same time, we're not sure that we need that number of people all the way through the 2020s. So for that reason, what we're doing is managing this with limited term 5-year assignments that give us the flexibility as we get into the 2020s and we may have more financial challenges, gives us more financial flexibility with respect to cost. Any questions about that?
So, some of the next steps for the board, as we mentioned, we'll be back this afternoon with a resolution for a service agreement for consulting engineering support. We would also expect in spring of 2018 that we would be back requesting permission to advertise for the contract to rehabilitate the units. You should see us again then in the fall. We expect it to be a 6-month process, so you'd see us again in the fall of 2018 with an authorization to award that rehabilitation contract. Prior to that, of course, we would reevaluate the feasibility of the overall project using contractor bidding data, contractor costs as received from those bid documents, and we'd communicate those results to you so you'd see that. The contract at this point in time, we're planning on awarding one unit with an option to rehabilitate seven more, which gives us some of that options and flexibility should things be different than what we had originally planned or approved on. We've got some options on how we execute. And again, the first unit outage would begin in the third quarter of 2021. And that's all I've got, unless you have some questions.
So I'd just like to be clear again that basically what we're trying to do is give you the big long-term picture here. That's a $350 million project long-term that we choose to go at in bite-sized pieces. This is the first bite in terms of engineering and design work. Then there would be a decision with respect to working with a vendor. If the economics are still good, which will be refreshed at that time, then it would be working with a vendor to, in effect, set up the purchase of the eight units, but they would be released one unit at a time, which allows you to, again, reevaluate along the way and say, is this still a good decision for the district?
It's a lot to digest. We have been asking for the longer term picture. Now, careful what you ask for. Good presentation.
Yep.
It really does give it's an important view for us as commissioners to get to be able to look down the road that far to understand exactly what the needs of the district are going to be well into the future. That's a real important part of our picture. So thank you.
Welcome.
Thanks very much.
And just so you know, these numbers are now substituted in for our financial forecast. They're an update from a year ago because we know a lot more because of the great work these guys have done. So these are now included in the long term. When you see numbers out through 2027, these will be included.
Okay. Any questions from anybody, any member of the audience? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, we've been talking a lot about budgets and capital, and it's time to refresh the discussion on a long-term debt philosophy that we discussed last year. The philosophy itself, we're not revisiting, but now the numbers underneath it are changing. With that, Kelly Boyd, Debbie Litchfield will be presenting.
Good morning. I'll start off as Debbie is powering up here. So I'm Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and joining me is
Debbie Litchfield, Treasurer. Good morning.
And now that you saw that picture, we're going to talk about how do you pay for that? So, that might be entering
great
your mind
segue.
Also. And Debbie's going to lead us through the discussion.
Thanks, Kelly. So what we're going to be talking about today is our financial strategies on the debt policy guidelines. We've been in a process this year in looking at the financial strategies of the district, and we started earlier this year with looking at the district-wide financial policies, which is the upper portion of this graphic here. That was completed in Q1, and then we moved on to looking at the business line financial policies, and we completed updating the business line policies for water, wastewater, and fiber. And then on the right-hand side there of this graphic, you can see the integrated electric conversation with the board was that we would establish some metrics that we would continue to monitor and evaluate. And so the next step that we go to in this process on the right-hand side is the revenue policies. And this will be discussion that will happen in Q1 of 2018. So today the focus that we're really on is on the left-hand side there, which is the debt policy information. So today, no action We're just going to be doing some review. What we plan to discuss is a review of the current debt philosophy and planning strategies that the board put in place in 2016. We're going to talk about some of the things that have changed since the last board session, including the 2015 to 2019 strategic plan and also the 2016 debt philosophy discussion. So we'll talk about what's changed. We'll update the plan of finance, which is an annual process that we go through. We'll look at the hydro funding tools and guidelines and update those guidelines. And then we plan to be back on December 4th to seek affirmation from the board on the updated philosophies, guidelines, and plans that we're discussing today. But overall, the concept is essentially that we're staying on path and continuing to execute our plan. You might ask the question as to why we're doing this now. It's important for us to be able to have our stable finances that increase our flexibility as we go forward, and then also having strong policies that support long-term objectives. So looking ahead allows us to take a measured approach to the activities that we may need to be doing. So in June of 2016, we discussed with the board the debt philosophies and the strategies. So here's the long-term debt philosophy that was adopted by the board. This was in support of strategic goal number 2, which was debt reduction. And it's intended to manage debt to create the financial flexibility and support low rates and stable electric rates, support low and stable electric rates, even when we see lower than expected results that are experienced. And it's important that one of the objectives that we're trying to do is to balance that financial health between having that really strong liquidity position that we've had and reducing our leverage, which is the amount of debt that we have. So we were really balancing those. But it's also important to be mindful of the other financial policy metrics that we have as well. And overall, the expectation that what we're doing supports the best for the most for the longest. Continuing with the long-term debt planning strategies that the board approved in June of 2016, just real quickly, there were a couple of the planning strategies that were around our financial policies, specifically related to maintaining our liquidity. We had an objective to meet our debt leverage of less than 35% by 2019, and we are still on path to do that. Execute planned accelerated reductions, plan pay-as-you-go capital, pay for that as we go along, as long as liquidity would allow. Manage to lowest net interest cost, and consider debt financing for modernization and expansion capital when needed. That we would borrow for long-term sustainability, not the temporary challenges, and that we would finance on a 2 to 3 year interval for efficiencies in issuance. We would also be looking at refinancing opportunities continually to ensure that as we monitor the market and our portfolio, are there optimizations that we can do. Along with the philosophy and the strategies, we introduced this operational plan of finance model. And this is adopted or was put in place in the process of adopting the 2017 budget. So looking at the 2017 budget and beyond, and so just to kind of refresh the framework of what this is really looking on a district-wide basis. So the forecast windows that we have there, the 2017 detailed action plans, this is really looking at what was put into the budget or expected to be put into the budget for 2017. So it's got a lot more detail associated with it. And then down below that is the next four-year time frame, which is more of the general expected steps from 2018 to 2021. And then the broader path is the remaining time frame that goes out to 2027 of the broad potential path that we might take. The activities that are listed are identifying what kinds of things we anticipate to have occur with respect to the annual scheduled principals that are just part of our payment process, if we anticipated any early debt retirements, if we had any new debt that was being anticipated during these time frames, any refinancing actions, and so forth. So we saw those activities for each of the different time frames. The specific action lists how much or the components around what we anticipated to do. So for 2017, we anticipated that we would have scheduled principal reductions of $23 million, plus that we would do a $29 million early retirement. And we did successfully complete that for 2017, so we accomplished that. And then we have what we were anticipating to have happen during the 2018 to 2021 timeframe and the dollar ramifications associated with those, and then the 2022 to 2027 timeframe as well. During this plan, it was expected that we would have our first material bond issuance that would happen in 2022. We also put in place that should we see lower than expected results, we wanted to have some mitigation plans kind of identified. And those included scaling back on early retirements that that had been listed in here, decreasing the cost of growth, delaying discretionary capital, and then also looking at incremental rate increases where it made sense to do so. So really what we're – one of the things that we're doing now is as we look at some of the things that we're seeing as we go forward, the scaling back on early retirements is one of the things that we're really focusing on at this point in time. So what's changed? Looking at our financial results for the next five-year horizon, we're, they're still very, very good, but we are forecasting that we're starting to see some challenges beyond 2020. What we're going to talk about here are the major changes compared to the 2015 to 2019 strategic plan. And on the left-hand side, we see a net wholesale revenue comparison. The blue dotted line is the 2015 to 2019 strategic plan of what we anticipated the net wholesale revenues to be at that during that planning horizon. The blue or the green solid green line is what the current forecast is representing. So we do see a significant reduction in the wholesale revenue forecast from a decline in the market prices that goes through 2022. From the 2018 to 2022 time period, we see a $67 million reduction in those revenues. And if we take a longer-term view of that, it's about a $340 million reduction. And this is primarily related to the decline in the forecast for market prices. In addition to that, with the reduction of the revenues, on the right-hand side, we see the capital investment comparison. And this looks at the dotted blue line again as the 2015 to 2019 strategic plan that identified what the capital investment plans were at that particular point in time. And then on top of that is the green line that represents where we're currently at today. So we're currently seeing a the capital investment is quite a bit higher currently than it was during the 2015 to 2019 strategic plan. And that is an increase of about $147 million for the 2018 to 22 time frame, primarily associated with the capital investment in plant and facilities that goes through 2022. Again, taking the longer-term view out to 2027, it's about a $125 million increase. So you see that there's a bit more increase in the capital in the near term compared to over the full life. So as a result of some of the things that we're seeing here, we're adapting our ongoing plans to the current facts and circumstances by implementing some of the mitigation tools. So the mitigation tools, and again, we're only focusing on the debt planning side of this, but there are the other tools that are available to the district. So on the debt planning modification side, what we're discussing doing is the scale back on the early debt retirements. For 2018, we originally had scheduled that we would be doing $85 million of reduction, which was inclusive of the scheduled payments that we would already be making. There are the required payment principal components. And then in addition, we had $61 million of accelerated debt that we were planning to do as part of the 85. So the scale back that we're proposing to do is not to do the accelerated component of the 2018, but to continue with the debt reduction related to the $24 million of the scheduled. For 2019, we're proposing that we scale back $44 million out of the $86 million we were originally planning to do and do $42 million of reduction for 2019. By doing these two scale back of early retirements for both 2018 and 2019, we still expect to meet the debt leverage ratio of below 35% by 2019. And in fact, we're just under 32%. So we're meeting that expectation, yes.
Debbie, what is the, assuming we hit that debt 31.6 debt ratio, what's the actual dollar amount at that point?
Of debt outstanding?
Right.
We will actually get to that in a couple pages.
Okay.
We'll touch on that one.
Right.
The additional mitigation tools that we're anticipating to do is to implement certain debt payments that are 6 months in advance of their scheduled payment. So we have most of our debt payments pay on July 1 of each year. So we have a certain bond series that we're anticipating to do 6 months in advance. And the reason for doing this is that we've got some net savings that we can achieve by doing that. Plus, it helps with our coverage support. We do anticipate renewed use of borrowing in the 2022 time horizon that's consistent with the long-term debt philosophy to focus on managing our liquidity. We also anticipate the updated guidance philosophy to borrow for electric modernization and expansion capital while continuing to fund replacement capital through electric revenues. And this will be some of the continuing discussion that we'll have in Q1 of 2018 as part of the revenue policy efforts. We also continue the annual debt plan review to ensure that we've got the right balance of liquidity and leverage, along with the other financial policy metrics that we're mindful of. So looking at the 2018 operational plan of finance, and again, this is part of the 2018 to 22 business planning and also the budget process. So the blue represents the areas that we are proposing to have some changes to what we saw with the 2017 operational plan of finance. And again, the 2018 is the budget activity, so that's got more detailed action plans. We are looking at net scheduled principal reduction in 2018 of $24 million, no early retirements, no new debt, and refinancing actions we would continue to monitor. For 2019 to 2022, those were our general expected steps, that we would continue to have scheduled principal of about $114 million reduction. We would have early retirements of $51 million, which is the 6 month in advance that we just spoke about. And then we start to see the new debt issuance of about $40 million that occurs during this time frame, and we would continue to monitor the refinancing actions. The new debt, the $40 million that we see, includes $1 million in 2019 that is for the state revolving fund for the wastewater system. And then the more material borrowing, we are still anticipating to be 2022, which was the same as in the 2017 plan, of about $39 million, and that's to meet our liquidity, $175 million minimum liquidity target. For 2023 to 2027, the broad path, we continue to see a reduction in our principal with the scheduled principal payments of $167 million, continued 44 early retirements of the six-month advance payments, and then we see new debt of about $231 million during that time frame. From 2018 to 2022, we continue to see an overall debt reduction, the continuation of the debt when we look at the debt that we're paying off and the debt we're taking on. We continue to see a decline. But as we get into the 23 to 2027 time frame, we start to see an inflection point where our overall debt begins to grow slightly. But when we look at the entire time frame, we still have a debt reduction of about $129 million from where we're at today through 2027.
Debbie, can I interrupt that? I think this is a really important point because this is a change, an important change. So what you see there is if you total up those numbers, 2019 through 2022, is a continued reduction in debt across that period. And then you get to that 23 to 27 period, and it basically begins to level off. So it's not increasing, but it's leveling off. So that's the change here, is that in that period after 2023, rather than further debt reduction, it'll be a leveling off of our debt. And of course, that depends. As you can see, there's been a pretty significant change since last year, just as things come up. But that's our best look into the future today.
Thanks for that clarification, Steve. So, Commissioner Arsenault, this is where it'll answer the question that you asked. So when we incorporate in the proposed facilities plan and the other capital plans that are being discussed, Rock Island, for example, and also the debt strategies that we've just touched on, the result of our financial policies is that we continue to meet all of our metrics through 2022. So specifically, some of the things I want to point out here is that on the liquidity component, we are anticipating that in 2022, this does include the borrowing, the $39 million of borrowing will be coming in here, and this is in the expected case. In the unusual case, it would be a little bit earlier into 2021. And then the other thing I wanted to point out is in 2019, this is where we're seeing our debt leverage ratio, that actually in the base case, we would be below the 35% in 2018, but about 32% in 2019, achieving our objective of having less than 35 by 2019. In all of the rest of the financial metrics, we're very stable, very solid on those. And then, Commissioner Arsenault, your question, is it the debt balance at that particular point in time? Is that your question?
Yeah.
So it would be about $473 million at the end of 2019. And that would continue to decline, as you can see on here. And then we would see the issuance that occurs in 2022, but the debt level really doesn't go up that much because we're continuing to do the scheduled payments as well.
Thank you.
So our prior discussion has been more on a district-wide basis. So what we want to do now is to focus in a little bit more specifically on Rocky Reach and Rock Island. So we have the hydro funding tools and guidelines. And just to give you a little bit of a refresher about our power sales contracts, we have the debt reduction charge, the DRC, and the capital recovery charge, the CRC, which are both components of the long-term cost plus power contracts. So these are really part of the plus portion. And these charges, the payments that we've received on these, have been used to pay for capital or can be used to pay for capital or to reduce debt. We have utilized these funds for the purposes of capital expenditure pay-as-you-go. So it's allowed us to not incur additional debt, but instead pay for the capital associated with Rocky Reach and Rock Island as we've gone forward. In 2014, we had discussions with the board, and we developed guidelines regarding the planning and expectation of the percentages that would be associated with these. Both the DRC and the CRC percentages are set by the board. So those we set some guidelines so that we would have some planning and expectation around what those would be, and we'll talk a little bit more about those in just a moment. But the objective was to accumulate sufficient funds from these charges to cover the hydro capital, and that the DRC-CRC funds were forecasted that at that point in time to be sufficient to cover the capital through our planning horizon. However, we've seen an increase in the investment in the hydro plant, and the facilities are now forecast to fully utilize the existing DRC-CRC funds, and that's going to prompt the need for us to provide some funding to Rocky Reach Rock Island in 2019. So touching just on the guidelines that were established in 2014, really focusing in on the percentage charges. So the DRC, the maximum charge for the DRC or the debt reduction charge is 3%. And again, this is set by the board initially and then can be changed on an annual basis with advance notice. The capital recovery charge maximum is at 50%. So that's currently where these charges are at. And this guideline was established so that we could identify at what point might those percentages change over time. And the expectation was that as the fund, the guideline for the funding level criteria was that as the fund reached these dollar thresholds, then we would consider whether it makes sense to reduce those as we go forward. So initially, we wanted to make sure that we had about up to $90 million in the fund available to cover the capital programs. And then should we achieve that and be able to forecast that we would continue to maintain that, then we could look at potentially reducing those charges over time. So this was just that guideline to kind of set what the expectation would be around doing that. So what has changed with respect to the DRC-CRC? So in 2014, the forecast at that particular point in time, and if you look at the blue dotted line, that's the 2014 forecast. The expectation was that with respect to the default rate, that it would be declining over time because we thought those funds would be continuing to grow and therefore it would allow us to be able to reduce the amount that we would have to charge each year and still maintain a very solid balance within the DRC-CRC. So the blue 2014 forecast line does assume some reduction in the percentage that would be charged each year. But what we see is that it grows to about 2024, and then it begins to decline. Contrasting that to the current forecast for 2017, we're anticipating that we would keep it at the maximum 3%, 50% through the duration. And you can see by doing that, we still see that the 2017 forecast, the green line, continues to decline. And it, in fact, is going to be depleted by 2019. And the key reason around this is that if we look at the annual contribution of the DRC-CRC, which is about $29 million average, when we look at the remainder from over the life through the end of the power contracts, the average is about $29 million. Of that amount that's contributed, it's important to recognize that the district contributes about 49% of that because we are one of those purchasers. And then the long-term purchasers, being Puget and Alcoa, contribute 51% of that amount that comes in on an annual basis. So in 2014, we were getting $20 million into that fund, and our average capital, again, over that full-time horizon was about $27 million. So we were having a positive each year, which is why we were seeing the blue forecast line continuing to grow slightly. In 2014, we were forecasting that by the time we got to the end of 2018, we would have $113 million remaining in the DRC-CRC. Contrasting that to 2017, again, the same amount of the DRC-CRC contribution is about $29 million, but what we've seen is an increase in the capital costs going forward of about $53 million on average, which is a net reduction of about $24 million on average per year, which is why we're seeing the decline in the green line. Questions on that? So the update to the hydro funding guidelines is that we would anticipate to continue to utilize the DRC-CRC balances to the extent that those are available, and that we would create new contractual debt obligations, and we refer to them as contractual obligations because the debt associated with Rocky Reach and Rock Island is under the contract is referred to as a contractual obligation. So we would anticipate basically a new debt obligation for Rocky Reach and Rock Island when those DRC-CRC funds are insufficient to cover. And those contractual obligations could come from the form of loans of internal unrestricted funds if we have those available, and then external borrowings if the internal funds are not available. The plans associated with what we would do with the hydros would be included in the operational plan of finance update. And we would continue to follow the stated guidelines should the future DRC-CRC balances meet the funding level criteria and evaluate whether it makes sense to do any reductions to those percentages at that point in time.
Debbie, I want to make sure that the importance of that is captured there. So earlier you said that the plan would be to go external for borrowing in 2022, about $40 million or so, if I remember
correct.
Right. But in this case, because of the DRC-CR implications, the external borrowing would be a bond issuance of some kind? Is that what you're thinking?
At this point in time, what we're anticipating is that from a district-wide perspective, to meet our liquidity requirements, we would need to borrow in 2022 to maintain the $175 million of liquidity. Mm-hmm. But internal to the district, when we look at on an individual kind of system basis, Rocky Beach and Rock Island need funding in 2029. So our expectation would be that we would use internal unrestricted funds to provide internal loans to Rocky Reach and Rock Island in 2029. Would be,
2019.
Excuse me, 2019. Yeah. That would be our first evaluation. If there were not internal funds available, that's when we would look to borrow externally. So we don't show external borrowing in 2019 related to this because we would anticipate at this point in time that we'd be using an internal loan.
I want to make sure that was clear. 2022 is the basic plan for bond issuance, but there is some possibility that it could be earlier than that. That's what the key point here, I think, is.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Yes. And the other thing I want to point out is that regardless of whether it's an internal loan or an external borrowing, the debt obligation associated with Rocky Reach and Rock Island with which the purchasers have to pay is a defined contractual provision. So the rates and the payment schedules and everything would be exactly the same, regardless of whether it was internal funds or an external borrowing. Any other questions on that?
On that timeline, it wouldn't be before 2019.
And
I'm talking about in the absence of internal loans, if we were to go to the bond market, it wouldn't be before 2019.
For the external bond market, that's correct,
okay.
Under the current forecast.
Okay.
Although I do always want to do that, but that's the kind of thing that we monitor continuously. And sometimes there are things in the market or things in our own operations that cause us to see opportunities and make changes to that. So while we're talking about our current plans, I do really want to give that feel of we are monitoring the conditions and may make decisions rather quickly that need to change the plans. And that's where some of these guidelines are really valuable because they give us kind of that thought process of the order in which we want to do things. And knowing that, for example, on the hydros, going first to internal loans, if available, is our first order of business. But if not, then we go to external. And because there's so many moving parts, plans can change. So this is our plan, but we try to be nimble.
Thank you.
And certainly if there's any of the external borrowings, it does require board approval resolutions, and we would be back to discuss any of those should that be the case. And also, you know, this is, we're talking about the potential of internal loans or another debt obligation for the hydros in 2019. So that would really be discussed in more detail as part of our 2019 plan of finance that we'd be doing towards the end of 2018. But we'd be continuing to monitor it continually as we move forward for what we believe to be most optimal, and then bring that back to the board for conversation. Okay. So this is what we plan to be back at the next meeting to confirm with you, as well as the 2018 operational plan of finance, is the debt planning modifications. So this is a summary of the information that we're talking about, which would include the scale back on the early debt retirements while still achieving our debt ratio target of less than 35% by 2019. We would implement certain debt payments 6 months in advance for some net savings and also coverage support. When needed, we would borrow for electric modernization and expansion capital and continue to fund the electric replacement capital through revenues. Utilize the DRC CRC funds for the hydros to the extent that they are available. And if those funds are not available, we would establish debt obligations first from internal unrestricted funds, if available, and then otherwise from external borrowings. And we would continue to the ongoing plan to review our debt to ensure the right balance of liquidity and leverage, and mindfulness of the other financial metrics as well. And these 2018 debt plans will also be discussed as part of the budget hearing for this afternoon. So you'll be hearing some of this again this afternoon. So next steps, between now and December 3rd, we'd be happy to answer any questions that come up and address those. And then on December 4th, we'd be coming back to affirm the board's support of the debt planning modifications that we've discussed. And then also the 2018 operational plan of finance will also be included in the approval of the budget process, budget adoption process. Questions?
And the affirmation will be in the form of a nod.
Good report. Thank you.
Thank you,
Debbie.
Thank
that was you. Very good.
Very thorough. A lot of work went into this. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay, we're going to try and get two relatively quick things in. Andrew's going to help us be quick here. So we need to update you on conservation potential assessment. That's a statutory requirement that we have. And we also want to update you on the LED streetlight program.
The first one's the conservation potential assessment. And so for today's meeting, it's informational only. The state statute requires us to set a new conservation goal every 2 years. This is the process by which we do it by. We bring a proposed two-year target to the board. And then we'll be asking in 2 weeks for you to look over that proposal and to take action on it at that point in time. We're also looking to propose amending our 2016 and 2017 CPA. That's the one we've currently been doing. There was an error found in some of the calculations, which increased the target from 1.66 to 1.78. We more than met the goal just last year by ourselves, so there's no chance of a compliance issue, but that's where we would like to do that as well. So this is just some background information. I'm going to go through it quickly. We have a new company that did the analysis for us based off of some of the issues that we had with the other consulting group. We used internal Chelan County data that we didn't have in prior assessments. We did audits. And then, of course, we always incorporating changes in the energy market to the calculations. And then an important component of the state statute is that it's consistent with the Northwest Power and Council methodologies, and this is the case. Our analysis is consistent with that. This was just a graph to show what we've done over the last, since 2010. We've acquired over 15 average megawatts of total savings, which is quite a bit. And you can see on the bars are the annual actual savings, and then the dotted line is the what our CPA was meant to, or what our CPA was. And so, just a quick background showing that we've been acquiring quite a bit, and we're proud of our programs. Our expected contribution by sectors is changing based off of the new data that we've gotten, the new commercial and residential audit specific to our county. We're seeing a larger degree of reliance, if you look over on the right-hand if we look on the 2018-2019 side, the residential is increasing, and this was expected. Commercial's decreasing. And industrial, which we had seen a decrease in, is increasing a little bit due to some opportunities with the new plants that are being built that were destroyed by fire and those sorts of things. And we're just getting some new, especially the new lighting technologies. The industrial, our industrial companies are really interested in that, and so they've really been upping their participation with regards to those measures. So getting down to where what we will be coming back for the request in 2 weeks, where the two-year target is the combination of the potential for those 2 years, 2018 and 19, combined, we're looking at 2.42 total average megawatts. And so that is what we're going to come back to as our compliance goal. Are the cost over that for those savings is around $16.50 per megawatt hour, which is still very inexpensive. And then you'll see the 10-year plan is just the going out to 2017. And you'll see that it'll increase over time. And you'll see this is a very similar trend as what we've shown on all of our presentations. And that new technologies are expected to come online. They're expected to become more cost effective. All those sort of factors that contribute to those things. And so you'll see you'll see those go up. Basically, the potential in the out years looks like it goes up. However, then we come in and we do all the necessary analytics to get into what we actually can do in the near term, and that's where the targets come out from. And so when we come back in 2 weeks, we'll be asking for action taken to set our target at 2.42 average megawatts, and then we'll have this graph as well as part of the presentation, and this will be our 10-year plan. The plans, of course, change based off of every 2 years they change. But the two-year targets, those will be set. So in summary, we did develop the conservation potential assessment consistent with legislation, regulations, and rules. The additional market values and Chelan County-specific data increased the target over the last compliance period, mainly in that we used regional data before, and a lot of times that regional data would say that we probably have less potential in our county than what we might have because it's bringing in data from, say, the west side, which they have a lot higher penetration of many of these measures. We didn't have as high of a penetration rate, and so we would have a higher potential there. And then for December 4th, it's a publicly noticed meeting, and we're requesting the board to take action on our proposed two-year target, 10-year plan, as well as amend our 2016-2017 compliance target.
Thank you.
The purpose of this presentation is to initiate a rate-setting process for LED streetlights, and there's two driving factors behind this. One, to account for the reduction in energy usage from the LED streetlights and take that into account within a new rate, and then take advantage of grant funding that's available out there that's associated with providing savings to the smaller cities that would participate in the project. And so, again, I've got some background information, which I'll probably move through fairly quickly. Stop me if you have any questions. And then we'll get to sort of where we'll be going in the next few weeks. So what's happened since the last time we met? We've engaged the stakeholders, both internally and externally. We completed the streetlight inventory and audit. That's all of the data. That's the basis for understanding how much savings we'll actually receive in energy throughout the county. And then we've been finding and obtaining additional funding. Specifically, externally, we've been meeting with the cities, the county, and DOT throughout this whole time period, working on standards, making sure they're comfortable with the project. They're all very excited about the project. We also did a pilot project of lights in five different areas within the city. and requested, sent notices to each of the two customers that were surrounding those areas asking for input. We were provided with very few responses, and those were either neutral or positive. And so so that was good. And then internally, we've been working with our rate and policy committee as well as our lighting standards group. Both of those groups are very important as we're moving forward with this. This was just the data showing kind of how much data there was. This is one section, I believe, of Kashmir. And we've got, I mean, all of these little blink, all these little dots are all of the lights. And each one of those has a ton of information associated with them, a GIS location, a number, what wattage, all those sorts of things. We now have all that information that we'll be able to put into the system. But we needed all of that to be able to understand how much this is going to cost and what are the savings. So we have some, we had some grant funding sources that we found. We obtained $287,000 in funding from Commerce. It's actually about $120,000 more than what we were expecting when we began the project. We went back for additional funding, and they provided it. And then we're targeting, and this is where a new rate intertwines with obtaining some funding. We're targeting about $500,000 to $550,000 in funding from the Transportation Improvement Board. That funding source will provide up to 100% of the cost to retrofit streetlights in the cities that are less than 5,000. So, Eniat, Kashmir, Leavenworth, Chelan, those areas. And then, what we plan to do is use some of this funding along with the PUD incentives to fund the other outlying areas. But that funding is contingent on the streetlight cost reductions to the cities that are being funded. And those are generally in rates, maintenance, those sorts of things. So this is where there's that interaction between obtaining grant funding and having a lower rate or setting a lower rate. And really what we're talking about, this graph was meant to just show where we're really focusing in on. We have monthly rates by we have monthly energy rates, flat fees that our customers can pay to us for per streetlight, and so those are made up of multiple components. We're focusing in on the energy component for the rate reduction, and really what we're looking at is there's a dollars per kWh, and then there's a volume based on lamp wattage. We're reducing the lamp wattage from 200 to approximately 38 watts, and that's where we're targeting in on that rate reduction. So what does that look like? It's about $1.43 per month per light savings. So we have over on the far side, right hand side of the table, looking at a proposed monthly charge for each of these different groups. These are sections within the rate that outline different options the customer can have, whether it's municipal owned, city, you know. Municipal owned, municipal maintained, municipal owned, district maintained. There's a whole long lit laundry list of those sorts of categories that are there. And so this is what we're proposing. And you'll see the existing wattage reductions there and then the existing monthly charge here over to the left. So what we're looking at doing today is seeking approval to set three informational meetings and a public hearing. Three informational meetings would be in Leavenworth on December 11th. Chelan on December 12th, and then here in Wenatchee on December 20th. Each of those will be at 5:30 p.m. in each of these locations. And then we would look to set a public hearing either the 2nd or 8th of January 2018, depending on the schedule.
So, Commissioners, maybe I could jump in here. So this was prepared in advance of the conversation we were planning to have this afternoon initially about that January scheduling. I understand that's still unresolved. So I just want to say we have a couple options. You'll see the next slide here is Andrew's proposed motion. We could set the first three informational meetings if there's consensus on that, and then hold for a later meeting the public hearing, or we can simply save the motion and we could act on it on the 4th of December, which is still in advance of your hearing dates. Although that might press the planning for Andrew in his team in terms of setting up those informational meetings. All of these are required under the district's resolution for rate setting.
There's also some timing periods associated where they have to be so far away from the public hearing. And so I think if the first two, I think, meetings are fine, no matter which way it goes. the meeting in Wenatchee would have to move earlier if it went to the second versus the eighth. So that's I wanted to be clear on that one too. Mm-hmm. So this was the proposed motion for consideration. It is long, but it's trying to encompass three informational meetings and one public hearing. But
I think there's a request for the setting of these three informational meetings.
You said you'd have to move the Wenatchee one on the 20th?
Yeah.
If we go with the 2nd?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We originally set it for the 2nd, and then there was some, we had, there may be some movement. So we were trying to find the,
right.
We were trying to find the right mix there.
So all of this, commissioners, is just simply recognizing that the first meeting in January would be Tuesday the 2nd, so the day after New Year's.
So would it be appropriate potentially to revisit this after we have that discussion?
Absolutely. We can hold this motion until that conversation is had, and you can act later. I can also take some time and revise it as necessary after that discussion so that it's cleaner for you to read in the record. Could you email it to me?
Yeah, I will email it.
Thanks.
I'd like to suggest a little bit of change of agenda here. We've got 5 minutes, and I think it would be difficult to get through the public power benefit discussion in 5 minutes. We do have one manager item, and I see Kathy is here. So are you comfortable? I'm just calling on you.
Sure.
This is talk about the annual discussion on fees and charges that is delegated to the general manager, but we keep you informed of the discussion that's going on there. Kathy?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Kathy Melton, Customer Service Program Analyst. And so as Steve mentioned, we're giving you the update on our annual review of fees and charges. I'm pleased to let you know we have no cost adjustments suggested for our customers at this time. Our fees and charges appear to be appropriately recovering those costs and effective at this point. So our focus on the revision that we took on this year was focused on reformatting the document so that it was aligned more in the order of how our customers will see those charges when they go through the line extension process or facility modification and new service connections. We also provided some clarity around service connection fees just to bring it more to a customer awareness that it's district discretion to size the transformer or also to recommend a specialty meter when necessary for certain types of loads. So we just wanted to add that clarity. When that happens, their charges are going to be estimated on an individual basis rather than being from that set pre-list on there. So trying to think of other changes that we had beyond that. It was mostly just focused really on those housekeeping and formatting adjustments, the clarity around those certain load characteristics that we'll call for a special meter, things like that. Revisions will be available on our website January 1. I'd be happy to get any of you copies of those in advance of that as well. Any questions? Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry, I ran up the stairs, so I'm huffing and puffing a little. I do apologize for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
All right.
I could just mention one of the things so we can get it out of the way for later. On the delegation of action items, there were two from the last meeting. One of them was to get you a value of the megawatts for the Acadia entitlement. You should have an email that came today that addresses that. And another one was on the estimated cost of repairs through C9 through 11. And I know Craig put that together the afternoon of the last board meeting. Mm-hmm. You should have that in your email as well.
Yeah.
So those two are taken care of.
Okay. And then just some fellow commissioners are aware, my intention is to this afternoon recess our meeting at 2:30. For Bob Parlett's memorial service, and then assuming we have business to come back to, reconvening at that appropriate moment in time. I'm not sure how we define that.
Well, the best way to do it is with a time.
Okay.
So we'll need to talk about that relative to the memorial service and the planned timing of it. I have that information in my office. I'll see what I can do.
Okay, very good. But that being said, we will come back, we'll recess now and come back to start with a public hearing at 1 o'clock and then public power benefit maybe could go right after that public hearing?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Or after the consent agenda. We'll do the public hearing, consent agenda, and then the public power benefit.
I'm hoping we can get through that, and because there's only three resolutions, get those done before you have your break.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Let's recess for lunch then.
Good.
Good afternoon. I'd like to reconvene the November 20th, 2017 meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District. We met this morning in a study session, and we had a whole lot to study. We didn't quite get done with it all, but we'll get it up and get it done after our public hearing. Coming back into session, the first item on our agenda today at 1 o'clock is a public hearing on the 2018 budget.
We're going to invite Craig Kuntz up to make the presentation.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Welcome to the second of two budget hearings. I'm Craig Kuntz, Senior Strategic Financial Planning Analyst. And what we will cover the timeline, specifically changes since November 6th hearing, go over 2018 budget summary and a five-year look, and finally go over next steps. There is no board action required today. Looking at our timeline, again, we initiated the budgeting process in September when business plans were finalized. The recent focus and continued focus has been on the department spending budgets and corporate budget details for 2018. We had our first budget hearing on November 6th, which leads us here today, our second of two public hearings presenting the 2018 budget details. We'll wrap up the budgeting process with a request for formal approval on December 4th. Business plans were presented to the board on October 2nd, which is the key building block of our 2018 budget. The foundation of the plans and budget is at the top of our balanced scorecard, customer owner satisfaction. So what has changed since the first public hearing on November 6th? Specifically, the district increased its capital spending budget for 2018 to include the strategic facilities plan. In particular, we added $9 million for work at Rock Island facilities, and we added $3 million for preliminary work related to the operations and service center. Total increase from November 6th of about $12 million. In addition, we implemented changes for the 2018 operational plan of finance, which Debbie Litchfield covered this morning in great depth. This plan impacts the 2018 budget by eliminating $61 million of optional accelerated debt reduction. The current planned debt reduction for 2018 is $24 million versus the $85 million that was shown in the November 6th hearing. Also, we added three limited assignment positions for all the significant work at Rock Island Hydro facilities. John Segesser discussed that planned work at Rock Island Powerhouse 2 earlier this morning. These positions are a project manager, a construction manager, and a mechanical engineer. And lastly, we made some minor changes to the O&M plans, which I'll discuss in a moment. This is a slide from Debbie Litchfield's presentation this morning. I just thought it would be helpful for those who weren't able to attend that meeting. These are the major changes since our strategic plan that led to the changes, suggested changes to the 2018 operational plan of finance. Since the strategic plan, we have seen a forecasted decline in our wholesale revenues of about $67 million in the 2018-2022 timeframe, nearly $340 million reduction in the 2018-2027 timeframe. In addition, we have seen our planned investments in plant facilities increase by about $147 million in the 2018-22 timeframe and by $125 million in the 2018-2027 timeframe, so an acceleration in earlier years for those capital plans. And as was reiterated by Debbie, we're always in the process of trying to find the right balance of debt reduction in conjunction with the increased investments of the districts, particularly all the work that we're doing at the hydros currently, planning to do in the future. And that balance has led us to the action of scaling back early retirements for 2018. So looking at a budgeted bottom line since the November 6th presentation, it has improved by about $300,000. The main items of that are our operating revenues decreased by about $100,000, which reduces our bottom line. That's just fine-tuning our net wholesale revenues as we get better information. We keep going with the process as we keep going down through time. Operating expenses increased about $200,000, which reduces our bottom line, and that's refinement to our operating plans. And in particular, there's a classification from a capital to an O&M project. And then our non-operating activity decreased about $600,000, which improves our bottom line. This is a net expense item, and that's driven primarily to increased interest earnings because we're holding back that $61 million of accelerated debt payment, and that's interest earnings on that $61 million. And all these changes together improve our bottom line from about 71.5 on November 6th, 75, $71.5 million on November 6th to $71.8 million that we have here today. Now, comparing the 2018 preliminary budget to the 2017 adopted budget, as I mentioned in the November 6th hearing, we see a bottom line that has declined by about $14 million. And I want to repeat, there's two main drivers to this reduction. There's lower power markets, which influence our net wholesale revenue, and the planned spike in operating expenses due to all the work performing out at the hydros. And if you look down at the bottom line, we can see the $300,000 improvement since the November 6th presentation, and it's about $1.6 million improvement since the 2018-2022 business plan presentation in October. Looking at our capital plans, here's the comparison of budget to budget. And the changes from the November 6th presentation included, as I mentioned earlier, you know, highlighted in blue, the Rock Island increase of $9 million for strategic facilities plan from $74 million to $83 million. And we see our corporate shared assets have increased by the $3 million for the strategic facilities plan from $18 million to $21 million. Taking those items into consideration, we can see the $12 million increase to our net capital expenditures from November 6th from $128 million to $140 million. Looking at our combined district expenditures, there's two moving parts here. The $12 million increase in the capital expenditures, that increases our total expenditures up about $12 million from the nearly $331 million discussed on November 6th to the nearly $343 million we have today. Looking at debt reduction, the previous November 6th figure was $85 million. Scaling back the $61 million of optional accelerated debt has reduced this figure to $24 million. So now looking at our total expenditures and debt reduction, November 6th was about $416 million. That's down to about $366 million. Here's a snapshot of our combined financial policies based on the 2018 preliminary budget. And as noted by the green check mark, we're on track. I'll look at the business policies. We're also on track. I would note that this is the wastewater is at 81%, which is below 100%, but that's a 2019 policy, which we're showing, and I'll show that later. We're showing that's on track to meet that metric in 2019. So here's a look at our test metrics. Showed these on November 6th. They really haven't changed since the November 6th presentation. These metrics in general are looking at how much our electric revenue cover our costs and how much we were relying on the wholesale market to cover the gap. And this is showing some early indication that there are some pressures on our electric revenues. And I'll look at the five-year snapshot here in a moment. Speaking of which, here's a five-year look at the district's financial policies, and this was presented earlier by Debbie Litchfield as well. It's the same slide showing that we are currently on track to meet all of our financial metrics. And the district budget and financial policy resolutions stipulate that not only do we present an annual budget, but we present a five-year plan that shows that we are meeting all of our metrics. And as you can see here, we are meeting all of our metrics. And I would highlight, as Debbie highlighted, for those who weren't here earlier this morning, we are meeting the 2019 target. We're a little below 32% in 2019. We're actually below 35% in 2018 based on the current forecast. Looking at our individual business line metrics, you can see that they're all on track as well. And this is where I wanted to highlight the wastewater. Even though it's below 100% in 2018, it is forecasted to be at 104%, meeting that metric in the required time by 2019. Now, this is looking at the five-year snapshot of our test metric of integrated electric. And again, you can see we're kind of stepping in and out of the established targets. And repeating that it's just showing that we may not be keeping up electric revenue, but as we continue to make significant investments in our assets. But these are only test metrics. We're just keeping an eye and monitoring them. So to recap, knowing that our highest priority is investing in assets and people, we have significant investments in 2018, particularly at our hydro facilities, and now we have incorporated the main strategic facilities plan at the hydros for Reach and Rock Island and a little bit for the operations center. We do see declining revenue forecasts due to the changing power markets, but we have no planned 2018 electric rate increases. But long-term sustainability without electric revenue increases is unlikely. And I'll pause there for any questions and comments.
Any questions, commissioners?
No.
So, next steps, we'll provide any additional budget details requested by the commission. And we will be back here on December 4th requesting formal board approval. The 2018 annual budget.
Since this is a public hearing, I don't recognize if there's any members of the public other than staff here at this moment in time, but I think it would be appropriate if there's any public input I would like to ask for it at this time. I thought he was going to testify. So, hearing none, nice presentation. Thank you for highlighting the changes. We look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks again.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Greg.
Commissioners, we have a consent agenda which was modified this morning to include resolutions 15, 16, and 17. What is the wish of the commission?
I move that we approve the consent agenda as amended.
Second. It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as amended. Excuse me. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Now back to public power benefit.
So we want to give you an update on where we are for 2017 spending on public power benefit, and Micah Lenderman and Felicity Saberhagen will be presenting.
Good afternoon. We're here to provide an update on the public power benefit program. I'm Felicity Saberhagen, business advisor, and with me is
Micah Lenderman, management analyst. A slide you've seen before, but at a different point in time. 2017, there were five projects, and they were assigned a total of about $3.5 million. There is about $550,000 still unassigned, and we're approaching the year-end, which means closeout. So the board will need to decide what, if any, projects will receive additional funding. 2018, there's still $1.2 million that's unassigned. However, there's less urgency about deciding what to do with those funds. Best for the most for the longest, and since the launch of the program back in 2015-2016. Parks issued over 4,000 day use passes since that launch. BB Camping, over 500 vouchers were given out. You'll hear more about BB shortly. Charging stations, the fifth station went live at the CTC, and we've had over 800 charging sessions. Fiber, when we wrote this, it was about 1,800. Now we're over 1,800 premises passed. Focusing just on 2017, Parks issued over 1,600 day use passes. Beebe, again, you'll hear more shortly, and the Plain substation site improvement, it was completed. Lovely fall day in Plain. This is a site from a photo from the river level.
Pretty cool.
Are those, are those all concrete steps?
Yes. For the sake of time, Felicity's going to do a quick high-level run-through of a bunch of projects. However, there is an additional deck called the Appendix, which has far more detail about project specifics, being project status, owner, expenses, details, etc.
For the 2015-2016 funding period, the current active projects are all on track, with the exception of the Haran area rehabilitation. That work on this project is on hold due to the inavailability of an adjacent landowner to collaborate on the site work. Total allocations for this funding period were $5.8 million, and this funding period is closed. For the 2017 funding period, five projects were allocated funding by the board. These are on track, and you will be receiving updates on both the Rocky Reach Visitor Center improvements as well as the Beebe Park project, camping project, in just a few minutes. There is still $549,000 in this fund that has not been allocated. For the 2018 funding period, the board made three initial selections, and there is just over $1.2 million available for future allocations. With that, I'd like to ask Casey Hall to come up and give an update on the Rocky Reach Visitor Center improvements.
Good morning, Casey Hall, project manager for the Rocky Reach Visitor Center improvements. Today I'd like to give you an update on the two major portions of this project. The first portion was the fish viewing window modifications. So we've completed the preliminary design and cost estimates for these alternatives. Here in the slide, you can see two renderings of these alternatives. There are some design questions we really can't answer until the fish ladder is dewatered in January. So once those questions are answered, we'll finalize the alternatives and select a preferred alternative. Construction for this portion of the project is slated to take place in the 2019 fish ladder outage. The second portion of this project was the fish viewing corridor improvements on the lower level. On the slide, you can see a cross-section rendering of those improvements. They included new exhibits such as the life of the salmon, fisheries management, and the journey of the salmon. It also included just general architectural improvements of the space. So we're currently coordinating closely with the O&M projects that are going on at the Visitor Center to ensure that we have power and communication pathways available for these new exhibits. So currently, construction for this portion of the project is slated to take place in late 2019 after those O&M projects are completed. So planning for the fish viewing corridor has uncovered an opportunity for public power benefit funding consideration. So while we were space planning for these new exhibits in the lower level, an opportunity was uncovered by the project team that brought up a question. Could we condense and move the Museum of the Columbia to the Visitor Center and provide a facility on a smaller scale than that was proposed under the Rocky Reach study to increase visitor count that we completed last fall with TCF? So we've completed some high-level concept designs and space planning and feel that this is a possibility. So what is the benefit to the district's customer owners in moving the museum to the Visitor Center? Well, first, it provides our customer owners with an all-in-one site for more convenience. This is an all-in-one visitor facility, was requested by stakeholder groups in that study. They really wanted a place that had all the amenities of Rocky Reach that they could go and see. Secondly, it increases Rocky Reach Dam facility security and worker safety. This combined facility would eliminate the unescorted access on the forebay and into the powerhouse deck, thereby increasing safety and security at the facility. The public would still have access to the powerhouse, but it would just be through guided tours, through Rocky Reach tour guides instead of free access. So it also allows us to update the Rocky Reach Museum of the Columbia and Visitor Center exhibits. So no major update's been completed to the Rocky Reach Museum since its last upgrade in the mid-70s. The stakeholder group's comments gathered during the study to increase visitor count at Rocky Reach felt the story that was told in the museum was still relevant. It just really needed to be updated to current technology standards. So this move would allow us to make that update to 21st century technology and still be able to reuse some of the existing artifacts we have in the museum currently. So it's a cost-effective approach to condensing and updating the museum and the Columbian Visitor Center. Using current technology helps us save costs by consolidating the footprint of the existing museum while still meeting our stakeholder expectations. Interactivity allows us to compress the story that's told in the museum by the graphics and written reading material that's there now and putting them in that information in interactive kiosks. So Grant PUD recently upgraded their visitor center at Wanapum Dam. In the slide here, there's two photographs of that Debbie Gallagher took for me of their gallery space. That's on the right-hand side in the middle with their exhibits. And then the lower photograph is a picture of one of their interactive displays. The upper photograph is just a rendering of if we were able to move those museum exhibits into the visitor center, what it may look like with that relocation. So this Grants PUD's visitor center, they've been able to incorporate multiple exhibits in a 2,000 square foot footprint. So next steps. The project team, as I stated earlier, has completed some initial space planning renderings and feels that adequate room would be available with some modifications to the theater level space in the visitor center. We'd like to continue to explore this opportunity and refine our cost estimates over the next few months and report back to the board with findings. Thank you.
Thank you, Casey. Next up is Ryan Baker to help present an update on the BB Camping pilot project.
While he's coming up, I just want to make sure we're clear. This would be an additional allocation from the $2017 to do the $70,000 study for the visitor center. So we would actually need to get your approval for that.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Ryan Baker, and I work for the Parks Department here. I'm actually the manager for the Chelan County PUD. I'm here today to talk to you about the BB Bridge camping pilot. We started offering this pilot program in April of this year, and it ran through October 31st. The budget was $30,000 for this program. If you notice the map on the screen ahead of you, we have three sites noted in red. Those were the sites that were available to reserve online or in person on a first-come, first-served basis. We promoted this with radio, print ads, special events, direct mail, web, posters, flyers, rack cards, and at community and social service groups, both in English and in Spanish.
The original estimated budget was $30,000, as Ryan had mentioned, but the full cost of the pilot program, including program administration, advertising, and foregone revenue from the campsites, totaled $52,000. Throughout the program, we made 640 vouchers available, and a voucher equals one night of camping stay, and eligible users were able to cash in vouchers for up to two nights. About 50% of the available vouchers were used through the program. About 10% were issued but then were canceled. Another 15% were issued and then didn't show up. So in all, about 75% of the available vouchers that in the program were actually issued out to customer owners, but only 50% were used.
All right, let's talk about lessons learned. What worked well? Well, participants that participated in the program overwhelmingly supported the continuation of the program. Well, what were some of the challenges? It was administratively intense, both in the field and in the offices, mainly with the reservation process. It was difficult to manage expectations. There was limited availability on holidays and weekends. And there was also some confusion with our campers when we run a first-come, first-serve campground when there was a few spots that were reservable. Schedule changes were difficult to get out to staff in a timely manner when they happened, for example, late Friday. And lastly, delayed confirmation in getting back to folks when they registered online. I'd like to take a moment, just a quick moment, if I could, to recognize Tennille Hatmaker in our office, as well as our staff in the field. They did a fantastic job of implementing this program, and I'm really proud of the way that, that they did that. So, all right, so what did we learn with this? Well, we learned that program users typically were seasoned campers. In fact, 75% of the folks that camped with us, it was not their first time camping. They camp at least five times a year. On the flip side, 5% of those folks that camp with us, it was their very first time camping the season. We learned that 250 customer owners received free vouchers. We also learned that folks, our participants, let us know that they appreciate being able to reserve spots in our campground. And not just that, they wanted to pick their own spots, which I thought was interesting. Program also needs to support the support of a live reservation system, which is good news because we plan to implement a system outside of this public power benefit in 2018. So, if the board wishes to continue the program, staff recommends the following. Suspend the program for 2018. This would allow us to implement the reservation system that I just spoke of, to test it and improve it, and also to identify options that make the program seamless with the existing processes that we have in place. And lastly, if the board wishes to continue the program, we would suggest a pilot in 2019.
So you've just heard the results from the BB Camping Pilot Project. If you have received enough information from staff to support the recommendation at this time, we can begin to pursue the reservation system and an improved process to potentially offer another pilot in 2019. However, if you need a little more time to contemplate that, it's understandable and we can come back. And as a reminder, we do have a number of check-ins throughout 2018 if you want to revisit that program. At this time, are you ready to support the staff recommendation?
Yeah. I have a question on the reservation system. Will this ultimately be used to look at Lincoln Rock and Confluence, since we're using the state's reservation system there? Is that sort of a thought with employing one here?
They would actually be completely separate. Our system would be just for our own parks, the parks that we operate. The state parks has one that's all around the state and includes all of them in
very
addition
robust,
to the ones
yeah.
we have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also add, Commissioner, that's something we did look into a couple of years back, and the state was not interested in us being part of that system.
I see. Yeah.
Great question, though.
You indicated the spots were approximately 50% utilized over the course of the season.
Mm-hmm.
How does that stack up versus the rest of the park?
So I'll ask Ryan, do you have information?
Are you talking about overall availability?
Overall usage.
Yeah.
These spots that were reserved for, you know, our customer owners were utilized 50% of the time. What's the status of the rest of the park utilization?
So the great question, and that really revolves around, quite frankly, the weather, what time of the year it is. For example, July, August, we're about 90% occupancy, where shoulder seasons, April, October, we may be about 5 to 10% full.
But comparing apples to apples on the 50% utilization, where would the rest of the park have been?
Okay, I got you now. So we are first come, first serve, so we don't have reservations, so it's very difficult to measure that apples to apples. If folks don't show up, we don't know that because they come and would register on site. They don't actually make a reservation except for through this public power benefit program.
So how about we can get back to you with a number, though, for the average usage rate across the park for the course of the season? The
sure.
entire season.
Absolutely.
But we'll take that as a take-home.
Sure. Yeah. That'd be good.
Noted.
The new reservation system, can you expand on that just a little bit in the coming years? What will that look like? Will that be for the entire park? Or?
Sure. Yes, I can expand on that. The reservation system that we plan to implement will primarily be for BB Bridge. You'll be able to reserve camping spots. We also plan to use that reservation system for our shelters as well. We'll combine it all into one program. We're actively looking at a company called Active which we've gone out and surveyed about 20 different companies and whittled it down to this. Part of our recommendation, Commissioner, is that we're not sure if that's going to quite hit the mark as far as the first of the year. We want to make sure that we have that in place before we work to proceed any further.
So I'm trying to look at that down the road. With this public power benefit, would it be more seamless, easier to operate? If someone, there was a no-show, what would happen then after a certain time? When would it be available for somebody?
Sure.
So, yes, ideally we would put this in place so that it was seamless with our existing customers. So if a public power benefit customer made a reservation, their reservation would be good as long as anyone else in the park, so that it's seamless to the end user. So from an operations perspective, we would be somewhat indifferent as to who is using that site.
Yeah, and I think we would no-show much like they would with a state park campground. If they didn't show up 1 o'clock the following day, we would release that site to the public at that time.
What does INIAT use for their park for reservations?
So INIAT currently uses call-in and write down on a piece of paper.
All right.
That being said, when I attended their last board meeting, they're also looking at going to a live reservation system. In fact, we're trying to work together to see if we can use the same one.
Good. Thank you.
So I think from our perspective, the question is your level of comfort with the recommendation to not run the program in 2018, give us a chance to put the live reservation system in place, and then come back and actually make a decision as part of 2019 of three choices. Would you like to run a pilot, decide we're just going to run a program, or not run a program at all? But we could make that call next year or about a year from now.
I'm comfortable with staff recommendation and then waiting to implement that new program and try another pilot and see what's learned and then go from there.
So we're looking for a nod.
Yeah, I think that's all it takes. We don't need a resolution on this because there really is just a decision not to do something in 2018.
So. I'd concur with Steve.
Yeah.
I agree. Okay. And I did talk with Commissioner Condon and she was comfortable with the staff recommendation as well. We need to come back to the Rocky Reach Visitor Center for a moment. So that is the $70,000 for the study is within the authority delegated to the general manager. But I wanted to make sure that you're comfortable that we're spending public power benefit dollars here. So I really would like to test your level of comfort with doing the study to see whether it's possible to move the museum into the visitor center.
Well, we have some unused dollars in there.
And I'm particularly interested in seeing knowing how large the other museum is, getting a closer view of how what will we, one, do with the artifacts that are there, you know, how will that be handled, and how will I'm sure in an interactive, there'll be a lot of video and a lot of those artifacts will be incorporated to that whole thing, but I don't want to lose heritage, you know, in the process. Right. Technology can do some things, it can't do some other things. So, but I'm all in favor of looking at the option.
We actually think of this as an opportunity to rethink the museum itself and even what the themes of the museum are, and whether these are the things that we want to, museums are there for inspiration. What's the inspiration that we want to cultivate in through the museum. I think there's also an opportunity to think about other museums in the area too, and how we share what activities they'll be pursuing versus the ones that are pursued at our facility. Good opportunity here to think the whole thing.
Square footage difference between the two that we know.
Yeah. Casey, you're going to need help on that.
Square footage difference?
Casey Hall, project manager. So square footage difference between
the existing museum
compared to the proposed new location?
It's a big difference. I can't tell you. I can't tell you the square footage size. I know that it's,
humongous.
It's half the size of the powerhouse. Less than that. What we have of usable exhibit space at the visitor center is probably around 43, if you include the upper level, putting some exhibits up there, which I would have to say that you're probably 30 by. It's in the 20s, 1,000 square foot. It's big. But there's a lot of space that's used in that. You're walking a lot where you're not looking. There's a lot of graphics. There's a lot of material. There's a lot of, just an example is the geology section. There's 6 cabinets of rocks, of igneous rocks. There's 1 cabinet. So you've got, you could combine some of those things and still tell the same story. If we wanted to stick with those stories.
Thank you.
We have some things out there that could use to be updated. So I'll just, I was out there the other day.
We're out there Friday.
There's a history of BPA that I'm not sure, it looks like it was produced by BPA and stops in 1980.
Yeah.
Not exactly sure how we ended up with that. There's a big opportunity here to rethink what we're doing out there.
That's always a good idea to refresh.
And I think the Grants Visitor Center is a good idea. If you get a chance to go down and look at that, Gallagher has always raved about it and really likes how they've laid that out, because it is a small square foot visitor center, but it has a lot of interactives. There's a lot of exhibits in there. So
that's at one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, a few years ago, we were presented a ceremonial drum, and that drum is there with a photo of the commission. Our oldest grandchildren were going through a few years ago, and our oldest grandson called to his sister and said, "Chloe, come on over here. Take a look at this. Grandpa's so old, he's now in a museum." So that one can go.
All right.
So, comfortable with proceeding with the $70,000 study?
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
That's a couple more things to ask about today. Close out of the remaining 2017 funds. If we do this budget revision, there would still be an additional $479,000 remaining after the revision. If the board does not have any other projects to bring forward at this time, we would go ahead and close out that funding for this period.
Yeah, and it would roll over?
It doesn't roll over. Any new projects would then be funded out of the 2018 funding period.
Okay.
We have availability of funds in 2018.
Yes. We still have just slightly over $1.2 million available in 2018 that has not been allocated.
But we have allocated through out of 2017 for the Visitor Center Museum.
Yes.
Correct. That came out of
the $70,000.
For the $70,000. Okay. Good. Yes.
And the $1 million that's already been allocated for the upgrade of the fish viewing.
The remodel.
The remodel. Yeah.
Shoot, we could build a quarter of a splash pad. Just kidding.
Oh, I didn't mean to cut you.
Okay.
Just as a reminder, we will be back with updates throughout the calendar year. So we probably will see you again next spring, and then definitely again to look at reallocation for the 2018 funds, as well as what we would do for 2019 in May.
Yeah. Well, when you come back for your visits, will you be giving us updates on how the reservation system is working out?
Absolutely. We will make sure that we have that available.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And aside the shoring up of the shoreline at the parks, absolutely great enhancement and functional. That is so nice. If you haven't had a chance to take a look at it, go look at it and enjoy it. It's really well done. Yeah, and then just kind of hanging out there for a little bit and listening to people. It's pretty much oohs and ahs. Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, we've got a number of resolutions. Resolution number 12.
Resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into a services agreement, SA number 17-100, with Universal Protection Services Allied Universal Security Services of Santa Ana, California, for District Unarmed Security Services. Michael Wilson, April will be presenting.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Wilson, and I'm the Senior Physical Security Analyst, and I'm here before you today to request board approval to award the RFP 1744 to Universal Protection Service, doing business as Allied Universal Security Services, and to authorize the GM to enter into a service agreement with them for the district's unarmed security services. As you know, the district utilizes contracted uniformed security officers to provide approximately 40,000 hours of annual coverage for the protection of district assets, properties, and people. RAM Security Services currently holds the contract, which will expire on December 31st of this year. And so this fall, the district published a request for proposal for unarmed security services. We saw this as an opportunity to discover whether there may be a new delivery of service that could provide additional value to the district. Seven companies submitted qualified proposals and competed in that process. The incumbent provider, RAM Security, based out of Portland, Oregon, opted not to submit a proposal, citing challenging logistics and economics of managing and operating an account so far outside of their service area. Our evaluation team carefully reviewed each proposal, focusing on quality of service at a competitive rate. We were determined to make the best decision possible for the district now and for our future. The proposals were scored in four areas: qualifications and experience, references, rates, and retention. After completing our evaluations, we determined that Allied Universal is the best qualified to provide unarmed security services to the district. Allied received high marks on every evaluation point and provided excellent references. I'd like to highlight some of their strengths for you here. Allied Universal is a national company and a well-respected leader in the contract security industry with a strong regional presence, including branch offices in Yakima, Spokane, and Seattle. They currently provide services for Grant County PUD and several data centers in the Quincy area. Their firsthand knowledge in protecting generation and transmission assets critical to the bulk electric system, and their familiarity with NERC-SIP standards, including a formal NERC-SIP curriculum for all officers, set them apart. Allied submitted the second lowest bill rate for services and the lowest vehicle rate. These rates were inclusive of a 3% wage increase to the officers in the second and third year of the contract. As a result of their competitive rates, we were able to add approximately 7,500 hours of additional coverage, meeting needs at Rock Island Dam and for night and weekend supervision, all while staying at the current contract amount under the 2017 RAM service agreement. Finally, there was a human component of this decision that weighed heavily on us. We have approximately 20 security officers on staff right now. With an average tenure of 6 years, these dedicated, hardworking, and fiercely loyal officers are a part of our PUD family. And so we were very pleased to see Allied's commitment to retaining the incumbent officers. Not only will they work to retain the incumbent workforce, they will immediately provide them health care benefits, honor the personal leave and vacation time that many of them have worked hard to earn and save, and all officers will receive a modest wage increase. All of these factors were advantageous to the district and clearly made Allied Universal the winning proposer. And so I respectfully request approval of this resolution to award RFP 1744 to Universal Protection Service, doing business as Allied Universal Security Services, and to authorize the general manager to enter into service agreement with Allied for unarmed security services at an estimated cost of $5 million over 5 years, not to exceed $1 million annually.
Any questions, commissioners?
No, I just, you know, I'm not good at math, but when I divide 40,000 into $1 million a year, that's $125 an hour. That's a pretty good price.
Yeah, so the contracted, there are two separate rates, contracted wage rate for the officers, but there's also a separate bill rate for vehicles, and we utilize four contracted vehicles.
Okay.
Good question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Resolution 13.
resolution rejecting the bid of Mid-Columbia Forklift Incorporated Bid A and Pepe Material Handling and accepting the bid of Mid-Columbia Forklift Incorporated of East Wenatchee, Washington Bid B, Bid 17-22 for the supply of rough terrain forklifts.
Thank you. Mark Belton, Procurement and Contract Services, standing in for Craig Weddle today as he is away. So we are asking to reject the two low bids on 17-22. We opened these bids on October 24th and received three bids from two different bidders. We're rejecting, we're requesting to reject the lowest bid from Mid-Columbia Forklift. They offered a Lift King brand forklift that did not meet the specifications listed in the bid, including diesel engine requirements, forward tilt capability requirement, max overall lowered height requirement, and the minimum overmast requirement. The second lowest bid was received from Pape Machinery, and it did not include a bid bond or deposit, as required in RCW 5404080. We actually did talk to Pape. They knew they were missing that beforehand. It was an oversight on their part, and they were unable to get it before the bid opened. Therefore, we're requesting to award to the second bid from Mid-Columbia Forklift for a Selleck brand forklift that meets all of our specifications.
So in bidding jargon, wouldn't look based on what you just presented, wouldn't that be the lowest responsive bidder?
It is the lowest responsive bidder, yes.
Yeah, so okay. Makes sense to me.
Appreciate the follow-up. Thank you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Resolution 14.
One we've already heard about today. This is the resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into a task authorization services agreement, SA number 17-173, with Stantec Consulting Services Incorporated of Bellevue, Washington, for professional engineering services related to Rock Island projects. We do not have an additional presentation on this one. John Seigerser is here in case you have any questions to follow up on this morning's presentation.
You made it very clear to me this morning.
any questions at this point in time?
No.
No.
Okay.
You did a great job this morning. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then lastly, Resolution 18.
Resolution 18, you may recall, was discussed at a previous board meeting, a resolution rescinding and replacing Resolution number 17-14114, adopting new telecommunication rates for wholesale telecommunication services by service providers on the district's broadband system. Again, we weren't planning to make a presentation on this because we provided one earlier. Wanted to also make sure that there was an opportunity for public comment if there is anyone in the audience.
Any questions or...
No.
18.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob. That'd be the quickest one right there, Bob.
And try and keep it down next time.
Okay, commissioners, we have resolutions 12, 13, 14, and 18 before us for our consideration. Is there a motion for approval?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the motion or the agenda resolution items as presented.
Second.
I moved and seconded to approve resolutions 12, 13, 14, and 18 as presented. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Do we have any additional manager items?
We do not.
Do we have any commission items? We have a little need to discuss.
Yeah, Commissioner, so I just, Eric Walquist. So the issue of scheduling in January will ultimately drive, I think, the streetlight public meetings, the informational meetings, and the public hearings. So there's a requirement in the board's rate setting policies that require three informational meetings for those of you who may not be so familiar since we haven't done them in some time. Three informational meetings to be held in various locations in the county. Leavenworth, Chelan, and Wenatchee are the three that are specifically mentioned at a minimum. And then a public hearing with rate action to follow the requirement is that those three informational meetings must occur within a window between 15 and 30 days in advance of the hearing. So depending upon the day that the hearing would be scheduled, we would need to set those informational meetings. We can do all that by motion once you figure out the date of the hearing. I would, or hearing equivalent to meeting of the board. Those informational meetings are not required to be special board meetings. They're informational for the public. Staff can attend. Board members can break them up. Board members can all attend if they so choose, in which case we would make them special board meetings if you have more than your quorum. So the last piece of it I'll add is I don't think that there's a need if we want to further discuss the timing of that January meeting. All of the proposed informational meetings are set to occur after December 4th. So I do think that we could wait and set those at a December 4th meeting. We could do some staff planning behind the scenes in advance of that to get meeting location and times and dates, et cetera. But
so the key
will be when you set your meetings in January. If the meetings stay as scheduled, so the first meeting would be Tuesday the 2nd of January, then we would need to change one of the proposed dates for the informational meetings. The December 20th would need to occur a couple days earlier. If you go with a January 8th as the first board meeting, the hearing date in January, so for example, moving the January 2nd Tuesday to Monday, January 8th, then all of these meetings, informational meeting dates work. So we can adjust. I think the trigger is what your January schedule looks like.
I don't know if there's any burn on that January 8th date versus January 2nd.
No, I did have a conflict, but I called at noon today and got it changed. So
the eighth works, but my concern is that it pushes out that second meeting where I will have a problem.
On that. Okay.
And so I just want to be clear, I don't know that we have to decide that today.
Right.
So
I do think that an option for you to consider is it's going to be very difficult for us to have a productive meeting on the 2nd.
Right.
There's a lot of staff work that goes into preparing for a meeting, and it's the week between Christmas and New Year's, and then we're walking in that morning right after New Year's Day. So I'm not expecting we'd be able to get much done then. Whereas I think we could by January 8th. We could try to structure this in a fashion where the January 22nd meeting would focus just on any resolutions that necessarily need to move and try to avoid a study session. So because I understand there are a couple of commissioners who now have conflicts, we didn't identify this early enough in time to recognize that there would be this problem. So I think we could manage that. Just get if there is work that needs to move through resolutions, schedule those for the 22nd, and then commissioners who are out of town under our new rules could participate by phone. And
oh, that's true.
So we could get that necessary work done. I think that would allow us to provide the greatest value. It gives us an opportunity to be able to set up meetings in a fashion where we get the work done that needs to be done in the month of January.
Yeah, phone contact would make it totally feasible for me.
Commission meeting in January is on the 1st and the 22nd?
It's on the 2nd, because when the
2nd and
the 15th currently.
2nd and the 15th.
Mm-hmm. So what are we saying?
We're talking about moving everything 1 week to the 8th and the 22nd.
Oh, sorry. Just keep with me.
You betcha. Yeah. But none of those decisions need to be made today, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
I think that we can accommodate the streetlight informational meetings with the hearing as well as your January schedule at the December 4th meeting. I don't think that we could accommodate we could certainly change your January schedule at the 20th of December meeting, but we would have missed the opportunity, I think, to set the informational meetings and have that hearing early in January. So.
Yeah.
It would help, though, to know if it's generally likely to be acceptable, because we'll start planning the work.
I think the 8th, for sure, in my estimation, for sure, I think it will be workable.
8th and the 22nd are fine, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. 8th is fine, and 22nd I could go by phone. And that would really be helpful.
Okay. I did not get a chance to confirm with Commissioner Congdon, so we'll check in with her before the next meeting.
Okay.
Okay. Any other commission items? Do we have any? No other meetings we need to set at this point?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. You did follow up already.
Yes, with the exception of the follow up from this meeting.
Well, that's next. Right. That's delegation of, isn't it? Yeah.
Yep, you're right.
Yep. Okay, delegation.
We only have one that I recognize. That's the average usage rate at BB Park over the course of a season. We'll get that one hopefully pretty quickly.
Would appreciate. Any additional public comment? Any other matters that need to come before the commission before we go into executive session? And as I earlier stated, we will be recessing at 2:30 if we're finished or not with our executive session. To reconvene at approximately 4:15 p.m. after the memorial service for Bob Parlett.
Let me just test one. We're done a little bit earlier than I thought we were going to be.
If we can't meet 2:30.
2:30 minutes of executive session and see how far we can get.
Okay. Perfect.
So let's do this. Let's go into executive session. We'll come out of executive session at whatever time you believe is appropriate, and then we can announce at that time whether or not we're going to recess, reconvene, or simply adjourn the meeting.
Okay, very good. I forgot to mention the reason for the executive session before we went into executive session, and is to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCW.
Thank you. I'm sorry I missed that.
We're coming out of executive session. It's 2:29 p.m. No votes were taken. No decisions were made. Is there any additional business to come before the commission today? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.